Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
Somebody scream bloody murder, it's out of my head. The execution is plot, controlled by the feds. Take legal action, they want me or dead. These niggas savages been trying to kill us for years.
Somebody scream bloody murder, it's out of my head. The execution is plot, controlled by the feds. Take legal action, they want me or dead. These niggas savages been trying to kill us for years.
We need masters in biology, zoology, to overtake Illuminati tricknology. Transform, reciprocate your mental state. Now make a date to overtake your objective. Show that through life that everything is connected, but not in categories, cause that's the devil's story. Symbols of cannibalism ruin your vision. Your thoughts formulate in your mind with no precision.
He paid a cruel price for what they call life. Dealt with it briefly, took him out that night. Some ask why, must say they hate the look in his eyes. Like a child to ill omen, they want him crucified. The last on the battlefield, the last alive. Besides, they don't want the African to survive. Sabo, the son of Satan, was involved in the plot. Legalized the homicide,
yo,
his soul going right.
Yo, attempted assassination of Mumia and Jamal, they set him up. I come to find out, Tupac, they wet him up. Pharaoh, standing behind my fucking curtains with a double barrel rehearsing. Ready for war now for certain. Biological warfare suits. Black gas masks, black boots, half-ass niggas become troops. My guns are dope with warriors of booty now. Plenty thug niggas of fruity now.
Freedom is that cold road seldom traveled. By the multitude, we need to dig through this gravel so we can cultivate this food. Motivate a few of you fools, regenerate the mood. Free ourselves from mental bondage, free ourselves from family feuds. And follow me through this prophecy. Building our colonies where our pillars and columns be. Bigger than the Coliseum, I call them like I see them. The devil does the devil dance. Now they want to murder Mumia, take action, it's the only
chance. They tell me, son, grab a gun or two. Money gon' come to you. Stop rhyming about what white people done to you. Look, burn a blunt or two. Screw who you wanna screw. Do what you wanna do, and let sin win for you. Kill all that teacher shit. It's too much cheese to get. And if Jesus exists, just don't believe in it. Eat the bread of wickedness. Join the global Satanists. Give death row sentences to black revolutionists.
Now they will play in God just to feel the power, not to justify that of you and I. Holding daggers up and letting you decide after passing information that's falsified. Stand behind a lie. What does it cost to die? What does it cost to live? Why do they specify these terms of why when they ain't the most high? What they fear they will kill, but the soul will never die.
context of white supremacy. Gus T. Renegade in for another broadcast, hopefully to share constructive information on the system of white supremacy. Today's date, Thursday, December 12, 2019. So I have been told. This is our debut study session on Mumia Abu-Jamal's Live from Death Row. First installment, book I'd said at the beginning of the year, 12 months can get by you really fast if you are not being mindful. But I'd said at the beginning of the year, our 10-year anniversary, we should read Live from Death Row. This book is not in my top 10, but Mumia has had a big impact on my understanding of racism, white supremacy, and influencing me to study and think about racism in a more critical manner. I read this book, wow, before the cows even existed. I read this book before I read Mr. Fuller. I read this book before I read the ISIS papers. Just huge impact. I read some of his other works. He's such a prolific author. I have so much respect for Mumia Abu-Jamal because he has been in greater confinement and was on death row for more than half of that time, but in greater confinement for basically 40 years and has been as consistently dedicated to combating white supremacy, racism, both personally with his own case and trying to extricate himself, and then regularly commenting on things that are happening all around the world. That's one of the reasons that I'm always proud to include some of his audio commentaries in our compensatory call-in. I think people, if you've listened to our Saturday broadcast for any length of time, you've probably heard 10 or 30 of his commentaries over the years, and he talks about so many things. I think Dr. Kamal Kamban, on one of his visits on the program, he said that Mumia Abu-Jamal is the best representation of a journalist. Just his commitment, the years of service, certainly his coverage of the MOVE crisis in Philadelphia. I mean, it's so much to talk about, but I thought it was important to get Live from Death Row in. You can check out some of his other works as well, but that should definitely be a book that we cover in the book club. And since it's such a cool topic, criminal justice reform, they call it, so much has changed since Live from Death Row was published. And this is such a unique book to read. This book was published in May of 1995. Do you know what a unique time that is? That this book was published right in the middle of the O.J. Simpson trial. In fact, O.J. Simpson will be mentioned in the segment of the reading this week, but it was written before the trial. So this is when O.J. is still cool. Beloved celebrity, not a raping white woman killing thug. But it was right on the cusp. But it'll be great to read the text. It is a collection of essays, so quite a difference from some of what we have read previously, but looking forward to it. Hopefully it'll be a fun read. I think there'll even be some overlap from what we finished up with Mr. Robeson's biography last week. But anywho, this is Live from Death Row, Essays of Mumia Abu-Jamal. We will get started. This is our first audio segment on the context of white supremacy. Live from Death Row, Mumia Abu-Jamal. Introduction by John Edgar Wideman. To Edith L. and William H., two southern souls, one dimpled, high-cheekboned, the color and aroma of sweet potatoes, the other short, muscular, coffee-colored, sans cream, embodiment of gruff love, aurored by cigar smoke, Phillies, who both joined the Great Migration North in search of that fabled land of equality, opportunity, and freedom for all. Up north, the northern tier of a Mason-Dixon line that marked the U.S.-Canadian border for some African Americans, was a cold and harsh land that shattered some illusions only to breed others. For the children, it was home. For them, it was the promised land. To them who scuffed and scraped to bring their brood to a new and better world, to their world, which might have been better. Acknowledgements. Kudos supreme to J.E.W., masterful in his introduction. Wow, like Pharaoh Sanders with a pen instead of a sax. The late revered Dr. Huey P. Newton, in his book Revolutionary Suicide, once wrote of his admiration for the African axiom, I am we, the natural notion that the tribe and the individual are one. In the spirit of that ancient wisdom, I wish to acknowledge my debt to the many members of the eternal tribe, to the nameless ones who braved hell's storms to make that wretched middle passage from West Africa to the American Southlands, to the blessed Reverend Nat Turner, who danced to heaven's horn, to Gabriel Prosser among those who blew it, to Shaka and those who held the line at Island Wana, to the spiritual sons and daughters of John Africa and the martyrs of the May 13th massacre, to Pam, Bert, Rhea, Mona, Teresa, Mo, Mary, Mella, Swella, and Franco, to Puga, Rhonda, Jay, Tiffany, Malachide, Boosh, all the seeds of wisdom, to Rose and Pixie, to Bev, to all who wear the name Africa, to all of them, to Roz Marley, and to all others who have sung for Babylon's fall, to Elder Curtis Mayfield, whose sweet rebel songs echoed across America and helped many a panther pass the day singing, we're a winner, and never let anybody say that y'all can't make it, 'cause them people's mind is in your way. To Rads and Rebels worldwide, to America Gagan Information Press, Partisan Defense Committee, New African Network in Support of Political Prisoners and Prisoners of War, ASADA, NAACP Legal Defense and Education Funds, Demba Diop, Hike Jurgen, Regine and Marlinta Suzanne, and the German crew, the nameless ones who did the indispensable work that makes a movement grow and touch others, to Yatama, Corey, the three Lindas, two Thurstons and one Rajan, William Goldsby, Abdul, John, Bobby B., John and Jenny Black, two from the same fire, Fred Horseman, Shep, Yuri, and Jamila, to the good bloods and folks toiling still in the bowels of Babylon, to Dr. Matulu Shakur, Sundiata Akoli, Geronimo Jijaga Pratt, Mazil Kazi, to PPS and the Black Cultural Workshops crew, Kojo, Emery, Ghana, Leonard Peltier, to Rochelle Maggi, sole survivor of the Marin County Courthouse massacre, acquitted by the jury but damned by the state in California dungeons since 1971 and in other California gulags for at least 20 years before that, to Ray Luke Lavoisier, Larry Giddings, to Stephen Luther Evans, a jailhouse lawyer extraordinaire who opened the door for countless dudes but who had death slammed the door before he could take that long walk to freedom, to the lawyers outside who struggled to help me join them, to Leonard I. Winglass, Esquire, Stephen Hawkins, NAACP Legal Defense and Education Fund, Dan Williams, to Rachel, the reminder, Wolkenstein, and Jonathan Piper, Associate Counsel, to Adwa Adiertoro, National Conference of Black Lawyers, Jack Reardon and Ashanti Shimaringa, Lawyers of the New Age, to all behind Babylon's walls, to Dell, China, Phil, Ning, Janet, Ed, Mike, Deb, and Chuck, soldiers and ministers of John Africa's revolution who are doing a century in Pennsylvania's hellholes for refusing to betray their faith in the teachings despite their innocence, who are prisoners of a political order bent on their destruction on August 8, 1978, May 13, 1985, and even this very day. To Whoopi, Danny Glover, the dynamic duo of Ozzie Davis and Ruby Dee, artists who have evoked imagery of a progressive ethos and who have dared to breach the barriers between art and life, like Ed Asner and Mike Farrell, to Alahi Bai Kanti, to griots known and unknown, Del Jones, Lynn Washington, Father Paul Washington, Cody Anderson, Kamau Ja, Free Eye, Terry Bison, Doc, a.k.a. Dr. Alan Berkman, ex-political prisoner who did time with me in Holmesburg Dungeon, Judy Douglas, Joe Nina Ambron, Askia Muhammad, to former fellow Panther turned griot, Kilu Niasha, because freedom is a constant struggle, Nguji Wa Thiongo, Dr. Chinsole, Dr. Hussein Abdiali, Bulhan, Dr. Ernest P. King, Dr. Francis Cress-Welsing, Dr. Franz Frenon, to one who escaped the slave coffle and became to Daruba and Tanakil, to men and women who are no longer Panthers but are still rumbling, Safia Bakari Alston, the late Nat Shanks, Captain Reggie Shell, Emery Douglas, Harold Jameson, Rosemary Mealy, Linda Richardson, and those who never apologized for wearing the black beret, to Francis Golden, who reached into the storm and pulled out this tome, to Noelle Hanrahan, who brought in the deadliest of weapons behind the walls, a tape recorder, to Jane and Alexander, to my brothers across this country, to the many good folks who remained unnamed but not unknown, to the vast extended family that is the brood of Edith, Keith, Lydia, Basil, Ali, Wayne, William, and their, her, growing progeny, Fluten Juice, Jaleel, Jamal, Tifa, Nibianta, Jabari, Wayne, and Mazimu, to Marilyn and Habiba, who fed that brood with their love. And lastly, but not leastly, to my wife, Madia, Wadia, Jamal, and the entire Jamal clan, to all my Ibans and Bentas, gifts from the divine source who revealed the face of love in human form. Preface. Don't tell me about the Valley of the Shadow of Death. I lived there in South Central Pennsylvania's Huntington County, a 100-year-old prison stands, its Gothic towers projecting an air of foreboding, evoking a gloomy mood of the Dark Ages. I and some 78 other men spend about 22 hours a day in 6-by-10-foot cells. The additional 2 hours may be spent outdoors in a chain-link fenced box ringed by concertina razor wire under the gaze of gun turrets. Welcome to Pennsylvania's death row. I am a bit stunned. Several years ago, the Pennsylvania Supreme Court affirmed my conviction and sentence of death by a vote of 4 justices. 3 did not participate. As a black journalist who was a Black Panther way back in my young teens, I've often studied America's long history of legal lynchings of Africans. I remember a front page of the Black Panther newspaper bearing the quote, "A black man has no rights that a white man is bound to respect," attributed to U.S. Supreme Court Chief Justice Roger Taney of the infamous Dred Scott case, where America's highest court held that neither Africans nor their free descendants are entitled to the rights of the Constitution. Deep, huh? It's true. Perhaps I'm naive. Maybe I'm just stupid. But I thought the law would be followed in my case, and the conviction reversed. Really. Even in the face of the brutal Philadelphia Move massacre of May 13, 1985, that led to Ramona Africa's frame-up, Eleanor Bumpers, Michael Stewart, Clement Lloyd, Alan Blanchard, and countless other police slaughters of blacks from New York to Miami, with impunity, my faith remained. Even in the face of this relentless wave of anti-black state terror, I thought my appeals would be successful. I still harbored a belief in U.S. law, and the realization that my appeal had been denied was a shocker. I could understand intellectually that American courts are reservoirs of racist sentiment and have historically been hostile to black defendants. But a lifetime of propaganda about American justice is hard to shrug off. I need but look across the nation where, as of December 1994, blacks constituted some 40% of men on death row. Or across Pennsylvania where, as of December 1994, 111 of 184 men on death row, over 60%, are black, to see the truth, a truth hidden under black robes and promise of equal rights. Blacks constitute just over 9% of Pennsylvania's population and just under 11% of America's. As I said, it's hard to shrug off, but maybe we can do it together. How? Try out this quote. I saw in a 1982 law book by a prominent Philadelphia lawyer named David Carey's, "Law is simply politics by other means." Such a line goes far to explain how courts really function, whether today or 138 years ago in the Scott case. It ain't about law. It's about politics by other means. Now, ain't that the truth? I continue to fight against this unjust sentence and conviction. Perhaps we can shrug off and shred some of the dangerous myths laid on our minds like a second skin, such as the right to a fair and impartial jury of our peers, the right to represent oneself, the right to a fair trial, even. They're not rights, they're privileges of the powerful and rich. For the powerless and the poor, they are chimera that vanish once one reaches out to claim them as something real or substantial. Don't expect the media networks to tell you, for they can't, because of the incestuousness between the media and the government and big business, which they both serve. I can, even if I must do so from the valley of the shadow of death, I will. From death row, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal, December 1994. Introduction. John Edgar Wideman. Recalling the horrors of African American history, accepting the challenges of our history presently places on us is like acknowledging a difficult, unpleasant duty or debt that's been hanging over our heads a very long time, an obligation that we know in our hearts we must deal with, but that we keep putting off and evading as if one day procrastination will make the burden, the obligation we must undertake, disappear. Mumia Abu-Jamal forces us to confront the burden of our history. In one of his columns from Death Row, he quotes at length an 1857 ruling of the U.S. Supreme Court. The issue being determined by the court is whether the descendants of slaves, when they shall be emancipated, are full citizens of the United States. Chief Justice Roger Taney states, "We think they are not, and that they were not included and were not intended to be included under the word citizens in the Constitution, and can therefore claim none of the rights and privileges of the United States. A perpetual and impossible barrier was intended to be erected between the white race and the one which they had reduced to slavery and governed as subjects with absolute and despotic power and which they then looked upon as so below them in the scale of created beings that intermarriages between white persons and Negroes or mulattoes were regarded as unnatural and immoral and punished as crimes. Justice Taney, speaking for the court, confirms the judgment of his ancestors and articulates an attitude prevailing to this very day. Mumia points out that Thurgood Marshall, the first person of African descent appointed to the U.S. Supreme Court, admitted just hours after his resignation from the court that, "I'm still not free." In another essay, Mumia calls our attention to Nelson Mandela. Released after 27 years in South Africa's jails as a political prisoner, Mandela, honored, celebrated as a hero, leader, and liberator of his people, universally acknowledged to be the most powerful man in his country, its best hope for peace, possibly its next president, still didn't possess the right to vote. Mumia Abu-Jamal's writing insists on these kinds of gut checks, reality checks. He reminds us that to move clearly in the present, we must understand the burden of our past. Situated as he is in prison, a prison inside a prison actually, since he's confined on death row, Mumia Abu-Jamal's day-to-day life would seem to share little with ours out here in the so-called free world. Then again, if we think a little deeper, we might ask ourselves, who isn't on death row? Perhaps one measure of humanity is our persistence in the business of attempting to construct a meaningful life in spite of the sentence of death hanging over our heads every instant of our time on earth. Although we can't avoid our inevitable mortality, we don't need to cower in a corner waiting for annihilation. Neither should we allow the seemingly overwhelming evil news of the day to freeze us in our tracks, nor let it become an excuse for doing nothing, for denial and avoidance, for hiding behind imaginary walls and pretending nothing can harm us. Alternatives exist. Struggle exists. Struggle to connect, to imagine ourselves better. To imagine a better world, to take responsibility step by step, day by day, for changing the little things we can control, refusing to accept the large things that appear out of control. The life and the essays of Mumia Abu-Jamal provide us with models for struggle. In 1981, to connect with my younger brother who was serving a life term without parole in a Pennsylvania prison, I wrote a book with him called Brothers and Keepers. In my research for the book, I discovered a chilling fact. My country, the United States of America, ranked third among the nations of the world in the percentage of its citizens it imprisoned. Only Russia and South Africa surpassed us. Who would have guessed that 13 years later, the powerful governments of two of the top three incarcerating nations would have been overturned by internal revolutions? We're number one now. And in spite of the warning implicit in the fate of governments that choose repression over reform, we're building more prisons as fast as we can. The facile notion of incarceration as a cure for social, economic, and political problems has usurped the current national discussion of these issues. As I traveled from city to city on a book tour last fall, the dominant issue dramatized in TV campaign ads coast to coast was, which candidate is tougher on crime? During the same tour, a hot story in national and local newspapers, on TV news, talk shows, and radio call-ins was the IQ controversy occasioned by the publication of several books claiming that the innate intelligence of blacks was lower than that of whites. Why such widespread, excited coverage of this hoary topic? that some people believe black folk are born inferior to whites and thus genetically determined to occupy the lowest rung of society certainly isn't news. Neither is blaming the victim of oppression a strategy with a history at least as ancient as Europe's slave trading in Africa. I recall sitting on college admission committees 30 years ago and hearing many of those who are voicing the idea of black mental inferiority today singing the same song then to rationalize underrepresentation of African Americans in higher education. So the fact that some experts continue to believe in innate black inferiority or proclaim it without truly believing, since they must know that the basic terms in the debate, race and intelligence, are problematic at best, malicious fictions at worst, and know a mountain of tables, graphs, statistics, and experiments can neither affirm nor deny premises and assumptions themselves imprecise and untestable, how many angels can fit on the head of a pin, is not news. Rather, the IQ controversy is an ominous sign of misinformation and repression going hand in hand. Exterminating Jews becomes easier if you're able to provide sound scientific reasons for pogroms. Postulating a biologically determined IQ deficit in blacks is more than malicious mischief. It is a transparent ploy to justify and erase from the national consciousness 30 years of backsliding from the promise of equality exacted by the civil rights movement of the 1960s. For African Americans, the backsliding has created a slightly larger black middle class on one hand, and on the other, a growing underclass of people of color trapped on the bottom rung of an economic ladder without any more rungs. For white Americans, reneging on the promise of equality has engendered class stratification and polarization just as severe as among blacks. On the bottom, the stagnant poverty of unemployment, welfare, poor education, and transience infect more and more of those who once considered themselves working people with dignity and aspirations. In the middle of rapidly shrinking majority beset by fear, trembling, and anger, they know they are walking a tightrope away from unforgiving poverty toward a mirage of boundless wealth that confers immunity from harder times. A tightrope they also know in their hearts leads nowhere unless they hit the lottery, except to more stressful, precarious steps along the razor's edge or a sudden precipitous fall. Finally, at the top stands a tiny minority whose wealth is a wall protecting them from the chaos of social instability, a wall that is both a reaction to the moral chaos of inequality and dependent on it. We face a social landscape with more, or at least as much, need for radical change than we faced in the 1960s, an era that produced, flawed though it was, by lack of follow-through, a mighty impulse toward change. Yet today, the opposite impulse drives us. Walls separating Americans by race, gender, class, and region are being justified and celebrated, but not in a spirit that welcomes diversity or seeks ultimate unity through mutual respect and reconciliation. Prison walls are being proposed as a final solution. They symbolize our short-sightedness, our fear of the real problems caging us all. The pity is how blindly, enthusiastically we applaud those who are constructing the walls dooming us. Mumia Abu-Jamal's voice is considered dangerous and subversive and thus is censored from National Public Radio, to name just one influential medium. Many books about black people, including a slew of briskly selling biographies and autobiographies from Oprah to OJ to Maya Angelou, are on the stands. What sets Mumia's story apart as so threatening? it is useful to remember that the slave narrative and its progeny, the countless Up From the Depths biographies and autobiographies of black people that repeat the form and assumptions of the slave narrative, have always been bestsellers. They encapsulate one of the master plots Americans have found acceptable for black lives. These neo-slave narratives carry a message the majority of people wealthy enough to purchase books wish to hear. The message consists of a basic deep structure repeated in a seemingly endless variety of packages and voices. The slave narratives of the 1800s posited and then worked themselves out in a bifurcated either-or world. The action of the story concerns moving from one world to another. The actor is a single individual, a featured star, and we watch and listen as this protagonist undergoes his or her rite of passage, south to north, rural to urban, black environment, plantation, to white environment, everywhere, including the language in which the narrator converses with the reader. Silence to literacy are some of the classic crossovers accomplished by the protagonists of such fables. If you punch in modern variants of these dichotomies, ghetto to middle class, ignorance to education, unskilled to professional, despised gangster to enlightened spokesperson, you can see how persistent and malleable the formula is. The formula for the neo-slave narrative sells because it is simple, because it accepts and maintains the categories, black-white, for instance, of the status quo, because it is about individuals, not groups, crossing boundaries, because it comforts and consoles those in power and offers a ray of hope to the powerless. Although the existing social arrangements may allow the horrors of plantations, ghettos, and prisons to exist, the narratives tell us these arrangements also allow room for some to escape. Thus, the arrangements are not absolutely evil. No one is absolutely guilty, nor are the oppressed, slave, prisoner, ghetto inhabitant, absolutely guiltless. If some overcome, why don't others? Vicarious identification with the narrator's harrowing adventures, particularly if the tale is told in first person, I permits readers to have their cake and eat it too. They experience the chill and thrill of being an outsider. In the safety of an armchair, readers can root for the crafty slave as the slave pits himself against an outrageously evil system that legitimizes human bondage. Readers can ignore for a charmed moment their reliance on the same system to pay for the book, The Armchair. The neo-slave narratives thus serve the ambivalent function of their ancestors. The fate of one black individual is foregrounded, removed from the network of systemic relationships connecting, defining, determining, undermining all American lives. This manner of viewing black lives at best ignores, at worst reinforces, an apartheid status quo. Divisive categories that structure the world of the narratives, slave free, black white, underclass middle class, female male, are not interrogated. The idea of a collective intertwined fate recedes. The mechanisms of class, race, and gender we have inherited are perpetuated ironically by a genre purporting to illustrate the possibility of breaking barriers and transcending the conditions into which one is born. Mumia Abu-Jamal's essays question matters left untouched by most of the popular stories of black lives decorating bookstores today, and therein lies much of the power, the urgency of his writing. His essays are important as departure and corrective. He examines the place where he is, prison, his status, prisoner, black man, but refuses to accept the notion of difference
and separation these labels project. Although he yearns for freedom, demands freedom, he does not identify freedom with release from prison, does not confuse freedom with what his jailers can give or take away, does not restrict the concept of freedom to the world beyond the bars his jailers enter from each day. Although dedicated to personal liberation, he envisions that liberation as partially dependent on the collective fate of black people. He doesn't split his world down the middle to conform to the divided world prison enforces. He expresses the necessity of connection, relinquishing to no person or group the power to define him. His destiny, his manhood, is not attached to some desperate one-way urge to cross over to a region controlled or possessed by others. What he is, who he can become, results from his daily struggle to construct an identity wherever his circumstances place him. Isn't one of the lessons of African American culture the reality of an unseen world below, above, around what is visible? Our history offers witness to the fact that our living, our art, and our spirits can prosper in the face of the most extreme physical deprivation. Aren't Mumia Abu-Jamal's words reaching us now in spite of steel bars and a death sentence another instance of our capacity to keep on keeping on? The first truth Mumia tells us is that he ain't dead yet. And although his voice is vital and strong, he assures us it ain't because nobody ain't trying to kill him and shut him up. In fact, just the opposite is true. The power of his voice is rooted in his defiance of those determined to silence him. Magically, Mumia's words are clarified and purified by the toxic strata of resistance through which they must penetrate to reach us, like the blues, like jazz. Remember the fairy tale about the emperor's new clothes, how a kid blurts out, "He's naked," as the emperor struts past, decked out in his illusory splendor? Whatever happened to the kid who spoiled the emperor's show? Consider what has happened to black men. Martin, Malcolm, Mandela, who have shouted out, "He's naked." If the fairy tale were set in an American city today and the child cast as a black boy, we know he'd be shot or locked up or both. Nobody wants to hear the bad news, the truth exposing the empire's self-delusions, especially those who profit most from the delusions. Chinua Achebe, the great Nigerian novelist, teaches us that the poet and the king must never become too friendly, because the poet's job is to bear to the people unglad tidings the king would just as soon nobody hears. The best slave narratives and prison narratives have always asked profound questions, implicitly and explicitly, about the meaning of a life. Part of the work of blues, jazz, our best artistic endeavors is, thank you, Mr. Ellison, to reveal the chaos which lives within the pattern of our certainties. In a new world where African people were transported to labor, die, and disappear, we've needed unbound voices to reformulate our destiny. Voices refusing to be ensnared by somebody else's terms. We've developed the knack of finding such voices in the oddest, darkest, most unforeseen places. A chorus of them exists in great time, the seamless medium uniting past, present, and future. The voices are always there if we discipline ourselves to pick them out, listen to them, to ourselves, to the best we've managed to write and say and dance and paint and sing. African American culture, in spite of the weight, the assaults it has endured, may contain a key to our nation's survival, a key not found simply in the goal of material prosperity, but in the force of spirit, will, communal interdependence. Because he tells the truth, Mumia Abu-Jamal's voice can help us tear down walls, prison walls, the walls we hide behind to deny and refuse the burden of our history. Part 1. Life on Death Row. Teetering on the brink between life and death. For there to be equivalence, the death penalty would have to punish a criminal who had warned his victim of the date at which he would inflict a horrible death on him, and who, from that moment onward, had confined him at his mercy for months. Such a monster is not encountered in private life. Albert Camus. Yard In. The last yard of the day is finally called. Capitals, 4th, 5th, and 6th tier. Yard up. The corpulent correctional officer bellows, his rural accent alien to the urban ear. One by one, cells are unlocked for the daily trek from cell to cage. Each man is pat searched by guards armed with batons and then scanned by a metal detector. Once the inmates are encaged, the midsummer sky rumbles, its dark clouds swell, pregnant with power and water. A bespeckled white shirt turns his pale face skyward, examining nature's quickening portent. The rumbles grow louder as drops of rain sail earthward, splattering steel, brick, and human. Yard In, the white shirt yells, sparking murmurs of resentment among the men. Yard In? Shit, man, we just got out here. The guards adopt a cajoling rather than threatening attitude. Come on, fellas, yard in, yard in. You know we can't leave yins out here when it gets a thundering and lightning. Oh, why not? Y'all afraid we're gonna get ourselves electrocuted? A prisoner asks. Ain't that a bitch? Another adds. They must be afraid that if we do get electrocuted by lightning, they won't have no jobs and won't get paid. A few guffaws, and the trail from cage to cell thickens. Although usually 2 hours long, today's yard barely lasts 10 minutes for fear that those condemned to death by the state may perish instead by fate. For approximately 2,400 people locked in state and federal prisons, life is unlike that in any other institution. These are America's condemned who bear a stigma far worse than prisoner. These are America's death row residents, men and women who walk the razor's edge between half-life and certain death in 34 states or under the jurisdiction of the United States. The largest death row stands in Texas, 324 people, 120 African Americans, 144 whites, 52 Hispanics, 4 Native Americans, and 4 Asian Americans. The smallest are in Connecticut, 2 whites, New Mexico, 1 Native American, 1 white, and Wyoming, 2 whites. You will find a blacker world on death row than anywhere else. African Americans, a mere 11% of the national population, compose about 40% of the death row population. There, too, you will find this writer. Control. It is from Pennsylvania's largest death row at the State Correctional Institute at Huntington in rural South Central Pennsylvania that I write. In the Commonwealth, I am but one of 123 persons who await death. I have lived in this barren domain of death since the summer of 1983. For several years now, I have been assigned DC disciplinary custody status for daring to abide by my faith, the teachings of John Africa, and, in particular, for refusing to cut my hair. For this, I have been denied family phone calls, and on occasions, I have been shackled for refusing to violate my beliefs. Life here oscillates between the banal and the bizarre. Unlike other prisoners, death row inmates are not doing time. Freedom does not shine at the end of the tunnel. Rather, the end of the tunnel brings extinction. Thus, for many here, there is no hope. As in any massive quasi-military organization, reality on the row is regimented by rule and regulation. As against any regime imposed on human personality, there is resistance, but far less than one might expect. For the most part, death row prisoners are the best behaved and least disruptive of all inmates. It is also true, however, that we have little opportunity to be otherwise, given that many death units operate on the 22+2 system. 22 hours locked in cell, followed by 2 hours of recreation out of cell. Outdoor recreation takes place in a cage ringed with double-edged razor wire, the dog pen. All death rows share a central goal, human storage. In an austere world in which condemned prisoners are treated as bodies kept alive to be killed, Pennsylvania's death row regime is among America's most restrictive, rivaling the infamous San Quentin death unit for the intensity and duration of restriction. A few states allow 4, 6, or even 8 hours out of cell, prison employment, or even access to educational programs. Not so in the Keystone State. Here, one has little or no psychological life. Here, many escape death's omnipresent specter only by way of common diversions, television, radio, or sports. TVs are allowed, but not typewriters. One's energies may be expended freely on entertainment, but a tool essential for one's liberation through judicial process is deemed a security risk. One inmate, more interested in his life than his entertainment, argued forcefully with prison administrators for permission to buy a non-impact, non-metallic, battery-operated typewriter. Predictably, permission was denied for security reasons. Well, what y'all consider a 13-inch piece of glass? The prisoner asked. Ain't that a security risk? Where do you think you'll get that from? The prison official demanded. From my TV. Request for typewriter denied. TV is more than a powerful diversion from a terrible fate. It is a psychic club used to threaten those who dare resist the dehumanizing isolation of life on the row. To be found guilty of an institutional infraction means that one must relinquish TV. After months or years of non-contact visits, few phone calls, and ever-decreasing communication with one's family and others, many inmates use TV as an umbilical cord, a psychological connection to the world they have lost. They depend on it, in the way that lonely people turn to TV for the illusion of companionship, and they dread separation from it. For many, loss of TV is too high a price to pay for any show of resistance. humiliation. Visits are an exercise in humiliation. In Pennsylvania, as in many other death states, non-contact visits are the rule. It is not just a security rule, it is a policy and structure that attempts to sever emotional connection by denying physical connection between the visitor and the inmate. Visits are conducted in a closed room, roughly 80 square feet in size. The prisoner is handcuffed and separated by a partition of shatterproof glass, steel trim, and wire mesh. What visitors do not see prior to the visit is a horrifying spectacle: the body cavity strip search. Once the prisoner is naked, the visiting room guard spits out a familiar cadence. Open your mouth. Stick out your tongue. You wear any dentures? Let me see both sides of your hands. Pull your foreskin back. Lift your sack. Turn around. Bend over. Spread your cheeks. Bottom of your feet. Get dressed. Several prisoners have protested to the administration that such searches are unreasonable, arguing that body cavity strip searches before and after non-contact visits cannot be justified. Either allow contact visits, they argue, or halt the body cavity strip searches. But prison officials have responded to this proposal as they have to repeated calls by the condemned for allowance of typewriters. Refusal due to security risk. For the visitor, too, such visits are deeply disturbing. In Rim v. Malcolm, the often cited case on prison conditions in New York, Judge Lasker quoted expert testimony from Carl Menninger, the late psychiatrist, who described non-contact visiting as the most unpleasant and most disturbing detail in the whole prison and a practice that constitutes a violation of ordinary principles of humanity. Dr. Menninger stated, "It's such a painful sight that I don't stay but a minute or two as a rule. It's a painful thing. I feel so sorry for them, so ashamed of myself that I get out of the room." The ultimate effect of non-contact visits is to weaken and finally to sever family ties. Through this policy and practice, the state skillfully and intentionally denies those it condemns a fundamental element and expression of humanity, that of touch and physical contact, and thereby slowly erodes family ties already made tenuous by the distance between home and prison. Thus, prisoners are as isolated psychologically as they are temporally and spatially. By state action, they become dead to those who know and love them, and therefore dead to themselves. For who are people but for their relations and relationships? Hurled by judicial decree into this netherworld of despair, forcefully separated from relationships, overcome by the dual shame of their station and the circumstances of the crime that led them to death's door, a few succumb to the shady release of suicide. Some fight Sisyphean battles, struggling to prove their innocence and reverse unjust convictions. Others live as they are treated, as shadows of their former selves and a pantomime of life, human husks. To such men and women, the actual execution is a fait accompli, a formality already accomplished in spirit, where the state concludes its premeditated drama by putting the dead to death a second time. Politics and justice of death. Although it might be said fairly that many people, both in and outside of prison, are utterly uninformed as to the workings of the U.S. Supreme Court, some among those on death row watch the court with acute attention. For them, the sudden resignation of Justice William J. Brennan, Jr. comes as crushing news after a season of sorrow. The recent spate of losses suffered by capital litigators spells all but certain doom for those who continue to petition the present court for legal relief. Where the issue of the death penalty is concerned, law follows politics, and conservatives won the socio-political battles of the 1980s on the basis of an agenda that included a ringing endorsement of capital punishment. The venerated principle of stare decisis, following rules of previous judicial decisions, meant little in the politically charged judicial arena. Statistical methodology and scientific and sociological studies, once valued tools for challenging state practice, now serve as meaningless academic exercises. McCleskey v. Kemp, 1987, was the clincher. The Supreme Court majority, Justice Powell, writing, assumed the validity of the so-called Baldus study, which presented mounds of powerful statistical data demonstrating gross racial disparity in Georgia's death penalty tallies, but rejected the study's clear implications. Justice Brennan's dissent telescoped the Baldus study's meaning. Defendants charged with killing whites are 4.3 times more likely to be sentenced to die than defendants charged with killing blacks. 6 of every 11 defendants convicted of killing a white would not have received a death sentence had their victim been black. Thus, the study showed that there was a significant chance that race would play a prominent role in determining if a defendant lived or died. The majority's permutations to its eventual rejection of that which it could hardly deny, that the race of the victim is a primary factor in determining whether a defendant lives or dies, proved the potency of the old adage offered by the satirical character Mr. Dooley, who shrewdly observed, "No matter whether the Constitution follows the flag or not, the Supreme Court follows the election returns." McCleskey's claim, based on sophisticated statistical and multiple regression analysis, buttressed by our understanding of history and human experience, was not disproved by the McCleskey court. Rather, it was rejected out of fear. In rejecting the conclusion that the facts established an unconstitutional infirmity, Justice Powell noted with alarm that McCleskey's claim, taken to its logical conclusion, throws into serious question the principles that underlie our entire criminal justice system. Precisely because McCleskey dared question the fundamental fairness of the entire system, his claims were answered with rejection. Delbert Tibbs, an African-American divinity student, once found himself tossed in with death row prisoners in Florida. Convicted by an all-white jury in 1974 for rape and related murder, he spent 3 harrowing years in death's shadow before appellate reversal. In speaking about his jury, he observed, "Peer, one of equal rank, one among equals. I knew the definition of that word, and there was nothing remotely akin to this meaning existing between me and these 7 hard-eyed white men and 5 cold-eyed white women who made up this jury of my peers. I knew that any peerage that they comprised, as indeed they did comprise such a thing, totally excluded me, at least in their eyes. Peers, indeed. I'm sure that in the eyes of that jury, I was not just another human being. Oh no, I was dangerous because darker, I didn't belong." On the McCleskey decision, Tibbs noted, "Apparently, that justice of the United States, writing for the majority, thinks that the United States is not two separate societies, one black and one white, and quite unequal. Justice is not meted out without regard to race, sex, economics, or previous condition of servitude. That justice was speaking as if there were no civil war and no chattel slavery. He spoke as if there were no history of lynchings, as if there were no Dred Scott decision, no Medgar Evers, Little Rock, nor Birmingham. Memphis didn't happen in that America. What does happen in this America is the cheapening of black life and the placing of a premium on white life. As Justice Brennan's eloquent dissent in McCleskey argues, the fact that this practice may be customary does not make it constitutional. To do justice, one must consistently battle, in Brennan's words, a fear of too much justice. Finding that fear firmly entrenched, he framed his arguments not merely as counters to positions with which he passionately disagreed, but also as warnings for the future, a day not dawned. It is tempting to pretend that minorities on death row share a fate in no way connected to our own, that our treatment of them sounds no echoes beyond the chambers in which they die. Such an illusion is ultimately corrosive, for the reverberations of injustice are not so easily confined. The court's decision today will not change what attorneys in Georgia tell other Warren McCleskeys about their chances of execution. Nothing will soften the harsh message they must convey, nor alter the prospect that race undoubtedly will continue to be a topic of discussion. McCleskey's evidence will not have obtained judicial acceptance, but that will not affect what is said on death row. However, many criticisms of today's decision may be rendered. These painful conversations will serve as the most eloquent dissents of all. Ironically, perhaps, the eloquent dissents of pro se court watchers are commonly delivered in the winning or losing of a bet. Inmates on the row often wager with one another on the outcome of judicial decisions. But as the real stakes riding on any given outcome are high, objective predictions are rarely possible. By viewing every decision through the prism of politics, I never lost a bet, even in cases where jailhouse lawyers claimed to have the law on their side. There is, of course, no satisfaction in such victories. Every bet won has been a case lost. Every case lost, a step closer to death. My predictions, based on political wins rather than law, have earned me the enmity of those jailhouse lawyers who continue to place faith in legal precedents and principles despite their growing pile of lost wagers.
Context of white supremacy. That is our first audio segment. We are still very early in the book. We should be picking up. I think there are a few different editions of this text, because the version that I have, it has, let me see, is this a new preface? Or I still think there, doesn't say new preface, but I do think there are different printings of this text. So the book that I have, we will be picking up on page 19. It's subtitled Death March and Lessons Unlearned. That's what we'll be picking up at, I reckon it could be 19, teetering on the brink between life and death. That's what we'll start our second audio segment. Anyway, context of white supremacy, Mumia Abu-Jamal, live from death row. Again, I just thought it was important to make sure we get this in the archives. It Mumia's had a big influence. He's played pretty regularly on the compensatory call-in. We include a segment where he's addressing, generally it'll be a very current issue, something that's happening right now. Again, I have always been extremely impressed that even from greater, not just greater confinement, let's not, you know, pussyfoot, from death row for a big chunk of the last 40 years almost, and he is still right on it, talking about things that are current and what's happening all over the world. Just super, super impressive, or as impressive as a victim of white supremacy can be. Number to dial, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. That number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943 pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Already got some of that overlap. Ozzie Davis, Ruby D. I can't say one without the other. But already had some overlap. I said that from what we just ended with, biography on Paul Robeson last week. Folks have thoughts, commentary about the first portion of the reading. Again, Mumia has written a number of books, which is also equally impressive because he's done all this writing mostly from death row, but certainly greater confinement. Death Blossoms, I read that. All Things Censored. He has a newer text. I have to look back on his site to get the title, but prolific author, journalist, convicted murderer, long list of titles, victim of white supremacy, Mumia Abu-Jamal. We'll get to the phone lines. I would encourage folks to kind of be mindful because he, I believe, may be getting at least a new case, a new inquiry. He had been submitting, you know, fighting to get an appeal on various grounds in his case. So I think that may be happening. He may have made a little bit of progress over the last few months. I know that was another guiding force in wanting to read this text at some point as well. Anywho, folks who dialed in, if you have comments to share, let's see, Thomas in New York, line should be open. If you have comments, questions, feel free.
Good evening, gosh, good evening. Evening to all the callers. Yeah, I just had some comments about the reading so far. I don't think I heard him say Sue Africa. I wrote that down. I was like, ooh, I was waiting for that name. I don't think I heard you read that name. So I was happy about that. And the stats about blacks on death row for killing whites, would not be there if they had killed another black person. I think that was pretty astounding, you know, statistic. I think it was 6 out of 11 blacks on death row were there for killing a white person. However, it brought me to, you know, that little clip you play, Black Lives Cost Less. You know, that was like a statistic that, boom, that blew that one out the water. Metaphor, it's not Saturday. But other than that, Gus, I didn't have too many more comments. Oh, question. Now, forgive me, I'm a victim, but I never really looked at Mumia's case as something that, you know, caught my attention that I needed to, you know, look at as just, you know, his brother on death row. I wasn't sure if it's a consensus that he did not commit this crime or not. Like, is this something, is he being framed, do you think, Gus? I'm not sure the circumstances behind the crime, and I was thinking that he was going to be talking about that in this book.
You will be a tad disappointed. That is not a major focus of the book. He, you know, talks about, it's been a while since I've read it, but I think if memory serves, I guess I could look at the chapters here. If memory serves,
He spends more time on the MOVE case, Sue Africa and all, than his own case. Let me look at the chapters again to be sure. But while I'm looking at the chapters, it certainly is not a consensus. The Blue Lives Matter folks certainly do not think that Mumia is innocent or was railroaded or, you know, anything of the like. I think, depending on who you talk to, certainly black people, his supporters, he named a lot of them at the beginning. The evidence is suspicious. This happened at an era in the early 1980s where he had already been doing a lot of work as a journalist covering the MOVE situation. You would have to put a lot of things in context for COINTELPRO, System of White Supremacy, and then Philadelphia specifically, which is a very important city where a lot of things like the MOVE situation had been happening, and Mumia as a journalist in Philadelphia had been covering a lot of this material, much like Paul Robeson. You have somebody who's talking about these things on a global issue, talking about racism, white supremacy, had been a member of the Black Panther Party, so he had connections with a lot of black people across the country. He's quoting from Dr. Newton, eloquent, intelligent, can explain all of this. In my view, I think this would just be another easy illustration of, you know, black identity. That's the hashtag that I used, but obviously that's going to depend on who you speak to. But again, I just looked at the article today, he might be getting a new trial. So, you know, it might be a growing consensus that, yeah, they did not do the correct thing with Mumia Abu-Jamal, and long, ugly story. But, yeah, I do not think he's going to get into a lot of that detail here. And, in fact, most of his books that I recall, there's a documentary on him. Most of his books that I remember don't deal a lot with his personal case. They deal with, like, the MOVE situation, racism in general, the death row situation in general, the statistics you heard about, you know, being more likely to be there if you kill a white person, 4th of July, Huey P. Newton. It's like a lot of his audio commentaries that I play on the weekends. Most of those don't deal with his case. Most of them, he's talking about other things. Yeah, I'm looking at the chapter titles. I think you'll be... He talks about Rodney King. He's talking about all kinds of things.
Got you. Oh, when he was talking about the treatment on death row, you know, how people... That television, Gus, the television, people are addicted to the television. That's the one thing they're not giving up. So, therefore, it quells any uprising due to the misconduct. You have to take a cavity search to have a non-physical visit. Like, you know, I haven't been around anybody but you. You know, like, it's just, man, you know, system of white supremacy, area law, you know, terrible. But just hearing some of those things was pretty eye-opening, especially, once again, that statistic. And surprisingly, Texas has the most prisoners on death row. I would have thought, and I've heard that my whole life, but, you know, just looking at the amount of people, you would think California would lead the way, but California doesn't have a lot of black people. You know, I think only 2 million in the whole state, a little over 2 million. There's Texas. I mean, forget about it. They got plenty. So I'll beat my line, Gus. Thank you.
Much obliged, Thomas in New York. If other folks are not informed about all the details on Mumia's case, this happened early 80s. I'm sure there's some folks who were not alive when all this happened. So go back. There's a lot of information. Like, there's a documentary and a lot of info and probably more details to come, especially if this ends up, you know, there being a new trial and everything. Like, oh, man, I don't know if it would be O.J. Simpson, but I mean, you would have a pretty notorious cop killer, former Black Panther Party member. I mean, this would be kind of like Assata Shakur. Like, oh, man, yeah, get be familiar. And definitely, if we have listeners, if you live in Pennsylvania, like local history, you should definitely be well versed on Mumia Abu-Jamal's case. While I look for other folks on the switchboard, I'll share some of my notes. And it shouldn't be too difficult to access this book. I had an electronic copy of this book. I'd already read it. I didn't have it in my personal library. But I said, hey, It would be nice. I like having options, especially if it's a book where I'm going to have to do narrating. I like having options. So I can have an ebook and I can have a hard copy, just, you know, in case. I said, let me see if they have a hard copy at the library. They had multiple copies at the library. In fact, they had so many copies. The library that is closest to my residence, I put the book on hold. They said, bam. There's a copy at that branch. We'll put it on hold and it'll be waiting for you to come pick up. I trot in to go pick the book up, you know, a few hours the next morning. Book is missing. The librarian can't find it. I think, interesting. But she says, don't even worry about it because what did I tell you? Seattle, all those libraries, she said, in our enormous library complex, we have multiple copies, so we'll just get one of the copies from the other branch and cite this one is missing. Maybe it'll take a day or so, and it'll be right there. It took about 24 hours, and boop, book was waiting right there. So I got the copy anyway. But you should be able to get it. I mean, this is, you know, pretty. I'll get into reasons about that later. But, yes, getting to notes. I am not a fan of the big roll calls in books, especially if there's no context. Even though I thought it was cool, like, oh, wow, you mentioned Dr. Francis Cress Welsing. And I just said he mentioned some of the very folks we already heard. Ozzie Davis, Danny Glover. I just saw his image today. He was talking about a reparations program in, I forget the exact location, but they were talking about a so-called reparations program. And I played that audio segment at the beginning where Mumia was talking about so-called reparations. But that's grand. To, you know, show a little love, people who have supported you, and certainly being in death row, any love that you get, I mean, wow, I overstand to the degree that I can not being in death row. But especially if there's no context, like if you've never heard some of these people's names before and it's just, you know, a list of 50 names of people that you don't know, I think it can lose its impact. Because you're just hearing a name. You don't have anything attached to the significance of this person or what they did. I'll take a specific example. Dr. Frances Cress Welsing, to hear her name mentioned. Now, I don't know if she invested time in his case. She could have. That wouldn't be a surprise, knowing her life and work. I don't know if he read her work. I don't know if he maybe heard her lecture. He could have seen her debate with William Shockley. Many black people did. Someone who was focused on the problem like Mumia has been, he could have. I don't know. But there's nothing provided. And then she's in the roll call with all these other black people. Whoopee. But then, you know, as he's talking about the problem, there is no mention of white genetic annihilation. Even talking exactly, I mean, the number of black males that are in prison and there for killing a white person and all of that. I mean, wow, I know Dr. Welsing has said a lot about that. She's not referenced there. I'm just not a fan of the roll call. I'm not a fan of the roll call. We don't do roll calls, right, on the pro. We don't start the pro. You know, salutations and greetings. Call out Dr. Ben and Gwen Ifill and Dr. Welsing, and I mean, we don't do that. However, those people do get mentioned on a pretty regular basis in context where it's connected to their work, it's connected to their life, what they were about, hopefully some of their scholarships, so you can understand what they thought the problem was and what we should be doing to solve this problem, what was constructive about their efforts. That, I think, is a different form of roll call, a different form of appreciation. I could be in error. When he spoke about the slave narratives, this is from the introduction, John Edgar Wideman, this is not Mumia technically, I thought that was really important when he was going through why Mumia's book is not popular and celebrated, although it's not The Hate U Give, right? It's not a New York Times bestseller, but like I said, they had multiple copies at the library, even if somebody did, you know, steal that one, say that, you know, Coon Gus is not going to get, you know, live from, we're not going to have him promoting Mumia's work. They had a bunch of copies at the line. That wouldn't surprise me, even if I wasn't in Seattle. I think it's pretty widely circulated, even though Live from Death Row is an older text published in the mid-90s. He has books that are much, much more current than this one, but I still feel like it's pretty easy to find. In comparison to the slave narratives, where he was talking about why they are popular, and he said that they kind of give you this idea that, well, not all white people are evil, because it'll be some helpful white people that help the individual black person out. It'll be an individual story, not about the collective damage. Often it'll be about an individual black person who's able to escape. He talked about even the refinement, which I thought was important, because that is very, very true. You see that even with the Help 21st century slave narrative. Where it's kind of focused on Viola Davis's character. She individually is able to kind of escape and do some writing where the rest of the black people in Mississippi, you know, keep hope alive, I reckon. Hang in there. Not literally. Even, you know, today, kind of what you see, it'll be maybe an individual black person. They can extricate themselves, but the rest of the... I was thinking like Finding Forrester. Did people see that one? That came out, I think, like... early 2000s, black male, he goes to school. They have a lot of those type of stories now, black person who's in poverty, and through education, being able to be around white people, they can, you know, pull themselves up by their bootstraps. I thought all of that was excellent in juxtaposing that with Mumia or even others. Although I would pause, not only is Mumia's book pretty accessible, like Asada Shakur's book is pretty accessible. She's also a convicted cop killer. Angela Davis is not exactly like obscure. Doctor, excuse me. Doctor Angela Davis is not exactly obscure. She was on death row, you know, contemporary. So, yeah, I don't know. It's hard to say. Let's see. Next, if that makes sense. Not saying white supremacy. That's some, I've read this book before, and I remember when I read this book the first time, like I said, I had not read Mr. Fuller's work. I had not read Dr. Welsing's work. Cows didn't exist. I was pretty confused about white supremacy racism. Reading this book now, oh man, I would not enjoy it nearly as much. Like, not being more precise in describing the problem, like when he was going to conclude and he was using the term race, and William Roden with The Undefeated, he has his podcast, he regularly it's a cliche, or not a cliche, but it's one of his axioms. He says the problem is not race, the problem is racism. Exactly. I feel like being precise, it's not conservatives, it's not the poor whites, it's system of white supremacy racism. He has more quotes as we go along, as we get in the second audio segment. I'll note them as we go. Even getting back to the roll call really quick before getting to some of Mumia and the actual body of the text. I felt like that in the biography on Paul Robeson, that there was a lot of name dropping, especially name dropping of white people that Paul Robeson hung out with and did that, had spent time with or was recognized by, that type of thing. And I feel to some degree, although it's a little different, there'll be some of that here, just kind of the authors that get mentioned. I think I mentioned some of that last time around, like there were a lot of references in the previous book that we read to white literary figures, Charles Dickens and the like. And I feel like sometimes to me that'll be a signifier as to who this book is intended for, as a way of appealing to white readers, and saying that this is not just a book that is intended for radical militant black people, that this is also trying to appeal to a wider audience with those type of references. Or it could just show their way of thinking, how they've been educated, maybe the type of school environment that they've been in. But that is something that I pay attention to. I think that'll pop up here as well. Like the metaphors, he has a lot of biblical metaphors, Valley of the Shadow of Death, quite a few of those. That's something to be mindful of as we're kind of moving along. Television, Thomas in New York picked up on that. I did as well. The power of TV. I've heard this before from people in greater confinement where they will talk about how they are not taking television out of prisons. I think when I lived in Georgia, this was talked about. They were talking about overcrowding in prisons and, you know, the expense and all of that. And, you know, I can't believe they've got television. Why do they have these luxuries? No good coons. And they said, we are not. This was the prison officials. They said, we are not getting rid of television here. That helps us maintain order. And even at that time, and I was very confused about white supremacy, racism at the time. Cows didn't exist, but wow. I thought that was significant. Television is that powerful that in greater confinement, they weren't saying, oh no, we got to have our nigger knockers. Oh no, we got to have our bulletproof vests. They were saying, oh no, we got to have our television to maintain order in the prison. Like, wow. Wow. And even at the passage, he said, TV is more than a powerful diversion from a terrible fate. It is a psychic club metaphor, but wow, used to threaten those who dare resist the dehumanizing isolation of life on the road. To be found guilty of an institutional infraction means that one must relinquish TV. I think Thomas in New York, he said they used television to quell uprisings in the prison. Like, wow, that is correct use of quell. Well behaved. Yes, sir. No, sir. Lights it. Yes, sir. I am quiet. Don't know what they're going to have on Netflix tomorrow. Might want to see old Lamar Jackson get out there and play. I'm well. Like, wow, that is a man. I mean, hey, victim of white supremacy. If I was in greater confinement, not even on death row, if I was just there, you know, on a misdemeanor, I might be doing the same thing. Like, I might be the biggest power fan and all the rest of it. If I had to be cooped up and you're about to go crazy and you don't have contact with anybody and you got racists doing God knows what to you and everything else, absolutely. I would be watching television all day long. Don't care what it is. We're going to watch Precious all day long. Let's watch Precious all day long. Like, man, but that is amazing. And the thing that it reminded me of is he said that when the institutional infraction means that one must relinquish TV. I have heard that response exactly from people who are not in greater confinement. I've heard people when they were on their jobs and they were talking about a problem, often being mistreated and being stressed and upset to the point that they, you know, might be considered doing something where they would get in trouble or resigning or something like that. Maybe I'm going to get fired. I'm going to get so angry. I'm going to get fired. And is that I try to calm down. Remember, ooh, I like my cable television. I have heard, like, that's not a one-time phrase. If anybody else has heard that from someone or said it yourself, please, you can be honest and share. But I have heard that, like, many times in my life from people. Like, oh, man, I would tell them such and such. But, ooh, man, Netflix, you know, I'm trying to. They got good things. I'm trying to watch. What a drug. We've had so many people over the years who've talked about purging television as a part of them getting into involved with counter racism. Them not no longer watching television was a big part of their transition. Be mindful of that. Be mindful of that, that even on death row, you can have a television. You can't have a typewriter. I thought that was extraordinary, too. You can have a television, glass and all. You can't have a typewriter. Let's see. The humiliation. Thought that was so important as well, because it's deliberate. This has been talked about as well, those anal cavity searches. And doing anal cavity searches, there's not going to be any contact. You're not going to have an opportunity to smuggle crack, any other contraband in your anus. We know all of your tricks. We've studied the coon. We make that our business. You're not even going to have a chance to do any of that. But we still are going to do these cavity searches and strip searches and humiliate. That is such a key aspect of white supremacy racism, to humiliate black people, especially victims of white supremacy. It was Colin Powell. That was who it was. Dr. Welsing used to reference it. There we. That's what I mean. I don't have to do a roll call. Mention Dr. Welsing on the program. VGQ to anybody who, you know, does loves roll calls. And if you mention Gus T, well, thank you kindly. Hope you still do. I could just mention Dr. Welsing with context, so you would have a reason. If this is your first time hearing her, you would know a little bit more about her life, work, and why she should be mentioned in a roll call. And then maybe I should read the ISIS papers. Check out some of her lectures. Maybe her visits to the cows. Dr. Welsing, she used to talk about Colin Powell. He, I guess after he left public office, what is that, early 2000s, after Bush the second, GW, when he stepped down, he had a line, I'm paraphrasing, but it was something to the effect of, I've had many, suffered many humiliations in my time in office. And Dr. Welsing mentioned this quote from Colin Powell, I believe, because it seemed to be related to racism, white supremacy. And he didn't go into detail. And she thought the same thing for the Obamas, Michelle and Barack, all of them, their children too. But that's the system of racism. And I believe that that was the word that was used specifically, was quiet humiliation, small humiliations. It was some form of humiliations in his time in office. This is someone, a general, served with distinction. No, you're just a nigger. We order you around, we humiliate you, treat you the same way we do any other nigger. Humiliations. Huge component of the system, and I mean that is flagrantly on display. And he'll give a lot more details of that as we continue. That's why I said he's talking about a lot of things, not really his case so much, but lots of things in the text. He will go into more detail about the statistics about a black male, black misandry. That would be another black male privilege. Black males being more likely to get the death penalty if their crime is committed against a white person like himself. He kind of is talking about himself in some ways, just not directly. More likely to get the death penalty if the violation is against a white person. He's going to talk more about that in much greater depth, so I will table any response to that until later. I guess the last, or I'll double check, make sure we didn't miss any. Oh, yeah, we did. How about I'll be quiet and let the folks who dialed in talk. We'll get our female caller first. Irie, did you have commentary?
Yes. Hi, everybody. Hi, Gus. I wanted to say that I think I was 19 when I heard Jill Scott's song, Love Rain, and she mentioned the lyric is, he took me on long walks to places where butterflies rest easy. He talked about Moses and Mumia. And, you know, the internet when I was 19 wasn't so prevalent or as advanced as it is now. So I remember her basically educating or alerting me to Mumia Abu-Jamal and then Black Agenda Report. When I started listening to that program, they would talk about him extensively. And, you know, I just basically wanted to express my gratitude for that exposure. Can I mention some books for that gentleman that called in about his daughter? Is this appropriate, or should I wait for Saturday?
Wow, now that is a toughie. Maybe we could do it at the end of the program. Would that work? Will you be here for the duration?
As far as I know, yes.
Love it. Truthful answer. Never can tell in the system. All righty. We'll do that because that is important. Requests for children's literature should be honored, I think. And it's on the book club. My goodness. Where else would this would have to be an appropriate environment? All right. So we have that. We'll get children's literature as well. Let's see. Henry in Chicago. Retired firefighter, also with us. If y'all have commentary.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir.
All right. Greetings, Gus. Greetings to all the callers and listeners. For the last caller, Irie, I was the gentleman that requested the literature, so it would be nice if you want to share it at the end if Gus requested, so I will be listening. Gus, I had a different experience in trying to get this book. The libraries that, you know, that I was looking at in the South Chicago and even South suburbs were either out. Also interesting was one library had it listed as missing as well. And it was a library that was close to me. The only copies that I could have gotten closest to me was the Harold Washington Library in downtown Chicago. So I'm just gonna order it online and just wait for it to come. But yeah, that was my experience. I did not find it easy to get it from the library, from my standpoint here in Chicago. You also referenced Danny Glover with the reparations. That is here in Evanston, Illinois. It's a suburb of Chicago. What they're trying to do is they're trying to use the sale of marijuana as payment for reparations. And I guess apparently Danny Glover is supporting it. He was here yesterday in regards to supporting it. So I just wanted to give context to that. In regards to the book, now, it's interesting that Mumia gets to, you know, write this literature in prison. And I was wondering how much of this literature has been altered or edited, and probably not Mumia's work, because, you know, when prisoners write letters, I think they open them and read them, just as what they call security. You know, I often question how much of this is edited, because I know you mentioned that he doesn't use white supremacy, or doesn't use not being direct about the problem. So, you know, I often wonder how much of this is edited, because he is in prison, so he doesn't have that type of freedom to write whatever he wants to, and he has to be very careful on what he writes. In the introduction, I was listening to the introduction, and it was talking about, trying to, whenever you want to oppress the people, you have to portray them with low IQs. I thought about, first of all, I thought about Lawford Stoddard's book, The Rising Tide of Color, where he, basically talks about black folks being the dumbest of all of the races. And also, too, you mentioned this William Shockley and his debate with Dr. Francis Quest Wilson, and how he tried to make this argument about, black people's IQs. What was so funny about that debate was, William Shockley had all these PowerPoints, well, not PowerPoints, but these charts and everything, and Dr. Wilson just came there by herself and shot everything down. She didn't have no charts or anything. So that was a very interesting and funny debate, how he had all these weapons and she didn't have anything. That's all I have right now in my life.
Much obliged, Henry, in Chicago. We'll get the children's literature. I thought that was a really important passage where they were talking about in the introduction about IQ and dehumanizing black people. And I, too, William Shockley, I went right to Dr. Francis Quest. Again, there you go. Then you put Dr. Wellesley in context. We just don't mention her name. Why are we mentioning her name? So many reasons. Let's count. There we go. I thought of that, too, when the IQ came up. The bell curve, because that is directly related to William Shockley. That's the same ilk. That's the same people. That's the same, crew. They hang out together, eat lunch together, at the coffee shop together, all of that. Sit around and talk bad about Mumia together. So one, I thought, because we talked, and I think this is when she was on the program in 2013, I think Dr. Wellesley debated Charles Murray, who co-authored the bell curve. I have to go back and find the newspaper article, but I think I have it, and we talked about it. I think they did a debate of some sort. He got paid like $12,000. She got paid $6,000. I think that's in the archives. That's one. Two, I looked online, and I found this report. This is at the Washington Post, published in 1994. So this is 1 year before this book was published, Live from Death Row. The fusillade of anger, bitterness, and debunking from a range of critics of the bell curve has pounded us relentlessly the last few days. Understanding that this is a tremendously painful and emotional issue, I still would ask black people to take their emotions out of the issue. Instead, let's use this ultra-hyped, carefully promoted book as an occasion to put another taboo topic on the table. Why are white people so obsessed with black people's color and genetics, but still unable or unwilling to talk about the white supremacist behavior that motivates this mania? Getting that subject discussed and aired can be the real value to blacks and society in general of The Bell Curve, written by Charles Murray and the late Richard Herrnstein. The book essentially argues that blacks on average have lower intelligence than whites, and while nearly every respectable scientist and opinion leader has blasted the book, the publishers announced Thursday that sales are booming and that they will cash in on free publicity by doubling the number of copies in print to 200,000. White people are projecting onto black people that something is wrong with black genetics when they themselves are concerned about their minority status on the planet, said Francis Cress Welsing, a Washington psychiatrist. I was interested in Welsing's opinion because she also is the person who most effectively debated William B. Shockley in the 1970s. Shockley became known for his insistent advocacy of the idea widely rejected in the scientific community that black people were genetically inferior to white people. He, like Herrnstein and Murray, belongs to a school of so-called scholarship that for more than 100 years in the United States has asserted that black people are inherently inferior to white people. Despite their hedges and caveats, most of these advocates of white supremacy have been roundly criticized by legitimate scientists who have underscored that these base estimations of black people are rooted in politics, not science. Thus, the data Murray and Herrnstein came up with in their 845-page tome are not important. What is important is their obsession and where such obsession might lead. Still, as black people, we expend so much physical and emotional energy moaning about the attacks that we rarely step back and examine beyond making the most superficial charges of racism what is behind the recurrent assaults. Just a tad, because Dr. Welsing comes up one more time. Now is the time for us to try to understand in depth why some whites have this need to spend so much time talking about black people's genetics with almost no focus on their own behavior. Too often in history, we find out where it does end. It ends in justification of Holocausts, in the justification of lynching, in the justification of slavery. Too often in our history, it has led to the justification of heinous acts committed when pseudoscience, woo, what a word, has given permission to those acts to occur. Murray and Herrnstein, linking black so-called intellectual disability to poverty, crime, and welfare, foresee the coming of a custodial state in which low IQ underclass is kept in a more lavish version of the Indian reservation. But in the view of many black people, the march to that state of affairs already has begun. We watch as the society gets righteous in its anger and passes punitive measures to attempt to address societal problems. Many of the nation's inner cities are ghettos. Hundreds of thousands of young black men are warehoused in prisons. Many more are dying from imported guns and imported drugs. Proposals for no parole and three strikes and you're out of society abound. Well-intentioned white people ought to be looking into this, but I'm not surprised that they are not, said Welsing, author of the controversial Cress Theory of Color Confrontation and Racism, White Supremacy. I will stop there. Washington Post, 1994, speaking of taboos. So this is 25 years ago, is that right? Wow. Woo! Reading is more important than watching television. Retired firefighter, thank you for your patience, sir. Did you have commentary?
Yes, greetings. I was just thinking the time that Mr. Jamal has been not only in greater confinement, but something called death row. 1983, I think I heard. But I think even through the process, I think it started in 81. I was just joining the fire department at the time. And so that's basically how I measure the torture that he has been existing in for such a long time. And I would estimate that he has not been wasting time. He's quite active. as far as someone going into greater confinement, having a skill, because from my understanding, he was a journalist before he was incarcerated. And he still utilizes his skill. I have down here, I'm surprised that there's anybody on death row, although I do know there are some who are on death row for, quote unquote, the murder of a non-white black person, but it's not a lot, that's for sure. And I would say probably even so, the reasons why that would be is primarily because they would use that dead black body as compensation to get at the person, the live person that they put on death row. That's if I'm understood on what I just said. That's probably why, in a lot of cases, why that non-white black person is on death row, and even some white people, only although it's probably only enough to fill up 10 or less in this part of the world anyway, that are white, that's for killing somebody on death row. Yes, he's very active. The last thing, the lack of the word white supremacy, I would say in my understanding that is to be expected in a lot of articles that we read, especially from non-white people, because it doesn't make us feel good, for one thing, to know that you have been dominated. Someone has dominated you, although at the same time, one is not saying that there is no fight in non-white black people, but it doesn't make us feel good, so therefore that would probably be a discouragement for a lot of non-white people for not either articulating the word, let alone talk about putting it in print. That's one of the reasons why I appreciate Mr. Fuller and Dr. Welsing, because they have went beyond their quote-unquote feelings and strive for accuracy when they are speaking to other people. Speaking or writing. And that's all I have to say. Thank you.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. Important observations. I think that's so important in terms of the role white people in getting this book published. Noelle Hanrahan, I think she does the audio commentaries. He talked about her bringing the recording to the prison. He mentioned Ed Asner, who is a white actor who was one of the characters in the Boondocks. If folks saw that, he was Ed Wunsler III, loosely based on the Bush family, I think. But he's white at the end of the day. Now, he has been a longtime supporter of Mumia Abu-Jamal. I think he's involved in different counter-racist projects. We'll probably get an audio snippet of him before we roll out Mr. Asner, modern-day John Brown. But if you, and again, if I was on death row, any white person, if they brought me a loaf of cornbread, you had better believe I'd be writing them a thank you note or anything else. Hope they get me another loaf of cornbread before, you know, I check out of here. So I totally understand. I'm not, you know, I'm just pointing out that I think being in such, you know, a vulnerable state as we all are, but I mean, that is hyper vulnerable. You're in death row, greater confinement. Well, he's not on death row now, but still greater confinement. Man, like, you certainly might be willing to compromise a lot more than you would if you were not in such a terrible predicament in terms of your vocabulary and how you articulate the problem. It's the same type of thing with Paul Robeson. The exact same type of thing with Paul Robeson. These would be the no-count whites that he was hanging out with in the 30s, talk about Paul Robeson, in the 30s and 40s, at the height of his kind of fame, he's hanging out with, oh, we're socialists, we're communists, you know, down with the system, down with the workers of the world. The same type of nonsense, because that's what some of these folks are. They say, oh, yeah, we're with the proletariat. We're Marxists. We're revolution. All of that nonsense. Oh, yeah, we're with you, Mumia. We're with you. Fight on. It's the same thing. It doesn't mean Ed Asner and all the rest of them. Amy Goodman, Democracy Now!, they have Mumia on a pretty regular basis. They'll call and have him from greater confinement. But when you have these white people, who sometimes might be the only reason that you have an outlet to the world, able to publish these books, able to speak so that people know that you're still alive, know about your case, so that there might be some interest for you to maybe get an appeal, maybe for you to live, because I think that was a part of him. If all of that wasn't happening, maybe he's dead. Maybe he's not even alive now. He could have been killed at some point. He killed an enforcement official, let's remember. So I think that's super important to keep in mind, as the point Henry in Chicago raised about, you know, what has been changed, what's been edited, whether it's a willful edit. And, you know, me and Noel Hanrahan sit down and talk, and maybe it would be easier to get your book published and more, it'll have a wider acceptance, i.e. more white people would be down to read it and back your cause to get you off of death row. If we don't talk about white supremacy, maybe let's say it's the conservatives. Maybe let's say it's Southerners. Maybe let's just change up the languaging a little bit. Super easy. In addition to, you know, the correctional officers might have a word or three to say about, you know, what you've written before it gets out of that prison. That, as was said, even your letters sometimes can be censored. Sometimes they don't even allow the letters to leave, unless I've been misinformed, depending on what you say. With that, I feel like I had one other thing I was going to say. The first portion, did I get all my notes? I'll have to, I guess the last thing I'll get in, I'll save it for the next time, these quotes there. We'll just do the second audio segment, that way we'll have ample time for folks to share once the second segment concludes. So again, for the version of the book I have, we are starting the subtitle Death March and Lessons Unlearned. For me, this is on page 19, but, you know, there are a few different pressings of the text. Context of white supremacy. Pennsylvania inmate, victim of white supremacy, Mumia Abu-Jamal. His 1995 publication, Live from Death Row, audio segment number 2.
Death March and Lessons Unlearned. There is a quickening on the nation's death rows of late, a picking up of the pace of the march toward death. The political pride is sparking movement, and judges in death cases are beginning to find themselves under increasing pressure to make the final judgment. As murder rates rise in American cities, so too does the tide of fear. Both politicians and judges continue to ride that tide that washes toward the execution chamber's door. No matter that of the 10 states with the highest murder rate, 8 lead the country in executions that supposedly deter. No matter that of the 10 states with the lowest murder rate, only one, Utah, has executed anyone since 1976. No matter that the effectiveness of the death penalty is not really debated, no matter that the contention that the death penalty makes citizens safer is no longer seriously argued. Habeas corpus, fundamental to English law since the reign of King Charles and to the U.S. Constitution since its inception, now faces evisceration under the hand of the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court, a possibility unthinkable just a few years ago. Many of the condemned, with constitutional error rife throughout their records, will soon be executed without meaningful review. States that have not slain in a generation now ready their machinery. Generators whine, poison liquids are mixed, gases are measured and readied. Silent chambers await the order to smother life. Increasingly, America's northern states now join the rushing pack, anxious to relink themselves with their pre-Furman heritage. Deterrence? The March 1988 execution of Willie Darden in Florida, exceedingly well publicized here and abroad, should have had enormous deterrent effect, according to Capital Theories, but less than 11 hours after 2,000 volts coursed through Darden's manacled flesh, a Florida corrections officer, well positioned to absorb and understand the lessons of the state ritual, erupted in a jealous rage and murdered a man in the maternity wing of a hospital. Seems like a lesson well learned to me. Yale Law Journal, January 1991. Descent into Hell. The man sat with arm shackled to the steel grill. A passing glance told much of the tale. A story of utter total alienation written in every line wrinkled in his pale face. His white, unstriped jumpsuit revealed the prison's assignment of the man to the so-called psychiatric observation unit. His inability or unwillingness to have eye contact with the men around him suggested avoidance. His tremors and his repetitive, rapid hand and leg clenches and other movements told a darker story, that of heavy or long-term use of powerful psychotropic drugs such as Thorazine, Stelazine, or Haldol, a side effect of which is tardive dyskinesia, a condition that renders its sufferers prey to a wild variety of inappropriate body tics and shakings. The spark, powerful mind-bending drugs prescribed to prisoners liberally, especially in light of a recent U.S. Supreme Court ruling that allows prison officials free rein to drug prisoners in state. The older prisoner with whom I was walking nodded in the man's direction. Check that guy out. I saw him, man. He plenty messed up. You're right, but he ain't gonna get no help here. The brief exchange was shelved with no apparent reason for recall later. A day later, during the midday meal, the unmistakable odor of burnt hair drifted sharply around the block. Somebody burning they hair, man. You smell that? I smell it, but that ain't hair. That's a blanket. Blanket hell, that's hair, man. Human hair. Fire up, big boy bellowed until others took up the call. Fire up, fire up. For 5 frantic minutes, the call resounded, and guards, the ever-present keys a-jangle, ran from cell to cell, from tier to tier, until the burning, smoking cell was located and the white, frothy liquid quenched the flames. Moments later, a naked man walked down the tier, his front darkened like wheat toast, an acrid stench rising like an infernal sacrifice. He walked slowly, deliberately, as if lost in thought, as if involved in a languid, aimless stroll on the beach. 12 hours later, he was pronounced dead with over 70% of his body burned. He was identified as Robert Barnes, 57 years old, of Delaware County, Pennsylvania, a recent transfer from Greaterford Prison to Huntington Prison. The man had reportedly warned officials that if he were placed in the hole, disciplinary custody status, and locked down, he would kill himself. He was placed in the hole. He killed himself. Although he had an extensive psychiatric history and had made a recent suicide threat, he was placed in a strip cell for 24 hours a day. When he was found, his burned jumpsuit had been totally consumed. Like many long-term prisoners in Pennsylvania with serious psychiatric and mental problems, Huntington's hole became a way station for a descent into hell. The visit. In the midst of darkness, This little one was a light ray, tiny with a Minnie Mouse voice. This daughter of my spirit had finally made the long trek westward into the bowels of this man-made hell situated in the south central Pennsylvania boondocks. She, like my other children, was just a baby when I was cast into hell, and because of her youth and sensitivity, she hadn't been brought along on family visits until now. She burst into the tiny visiting room, her brown eyes aglitter with happiness, stopped, stunned, staring at the glassy barrier between us, and burst into tears at this arrogant attempt at state separation. In milliseconds, sadness and shock shifted into fury as her petite fingers curled into tight fists, which banged and pummeled the plexiglass barrier, which shuddered and shimmied but didn't shatter. "Break it! Break it!" she screamed. Her mother, recovering from her shock, bundled up Hamida in her arms as sobs rocked them both. My eyes filled to the brim, my nose clogged. Her unspoken words echoed in my consciousness. Why can't I hug him? Why can't we kiss? Why can't I sit in his lap? Why can't we touch? Why not? I turned away to recover. I put on a silly face, turned back, called her to me, and talked silly to her. Girl, how you gonna breathe with all them boogies in your nose? Amid the rolling trail of tears, a twinkle started like dawn, and before long, the shy beginnings of a smile meandered across her face as we talked silly talk. I reminded her of how she used to hug our cat until she almost strangled the poor animal, and Hamida's denials were developing into laughter. The three of us talked silly talk, liberally mixed with serious talk, and before long, our visit came to an end. Her smile restored, she uttered a parting poem that we used to say over the phone. I love you, I miss you, and when I see you, I'm gonna kiss you. The three of us laughed and they left. Over 5 years have passed since that visit, but I remember it like it was an hour ago, the slams of her tiny fists against that ugly barrier, her instinctual rage against it, the state-made blockade raised under the rubric of security, her hot tears. They haunt me. November 1994. On Tilt by State Design. Harry Washington shrieks out of an internal orgy of psychic pain. Niggers, keep my family's name out your mouth. You freak. You filth. You racist garbage. All my family believe in God. Keep your twisted satanic filth to yourself. Keep my family's name out your nasty mouth. I have stopped the reflexive glance down in front of Harry's cell, for now, as in all the times in the past, I know no one is out near his ground-level cell. I know Harry is in a mouth-foaming rage because of the ceaseless noises echoing within the chambers of his tortured mind. For Harry and I are among the growing numbers of Pennsylvanians on death row, and Harry, because of mind-snapping isolation, a bitterly racist environment, and the ironies, the auguries of fate, has begun the slide from depression through deterioration to dementia. While we both share the deadening effects of isolation and an environment straight out of the redneck boondocks, Harry, like so many others, has slipped. Many of his tormentors, here both real and imagined, have named him Nut and describe him as on tilt. Perhaps the cruel twists of fate popped his cork. Who can say? A young man, once a correctional officer, now a death row convict. Once he wore the keys, now he hears the keys in an agonizing wait for death. The conditions of most of America's death rows create Harry Washington's by the score. Mix in solitary confinement, around the clock, lock in, no contact visits, no prison jobs, no educational programs by which to grow, psychiatric treatment facilities designed only to drug you into a coma, ladle in hostile, overtly racist prison guards and staff, add the weight of the falling away of family ties, and you have all the fixings of a stressful psychic stew designed to deteriorate, to erode one's humanity, designed, that is, by the state with full knowledge of its effects. Nearly a century ago, a Colorado man was sentenced to death for killing his wife. On his arrival at Colorado State Penitentiary, James Medley was placed in solitary. Medley promptly brought an original writ of habeas corpus in the U.S. Supreme Court, which in 1890 consisted of 6 Republicans and 3 Democrats. In the case, in re Medley, 134 U.S. 160, 1890, the court reached back to Old English law to the early 1700s of King George II to conclude that solitary confinement was an additional punishment of the most important and painful character and, as applied to Medley, unconstitutional. Fast forward nearly a century to 1986 to the infamous federal court decision of Peterkin v. Jeffries, where Pennsylvania death row inmates sought to have solitary confinement declared unconstitutional, and one hears a judge deny relief, saying, in the immortal words of now Chief Justice Rehnquist, nobody promised them a rose garden, that is, solitary is okay. The notion that human progress is marked by an evolving standard of decency from the less civilized to the more civilized, from the more restrictive to the less restrictive, from tyranny to expanding freedom, dies a quick death on the rocks of today's Rehnquistian courts. Indeed, what other court could make the Republican-controlled Southern Harlan Fuller Court of the 1890s seem positively radical by comparison? Harry constitutes his howlings in mindless mutterings of rage at no one in particular. June 1989. On death row, fade to black. It is about time the court faced the fact that the white people in the South don't like the colored people. William H. Rehnquist, law clerk, 1953. A light-skinned native of Lenape lineage sidles up to a fellow prisoner in nearby steel cage for a bit of small talk. "Damn, man," the Indian youth exclaims in his northeastern Pennsylvania nasal twang, "I've been here too damn long." "Why you say that, Running Bear?" "Well, 'cause I caught myself saying police instead of police and foe instead of for." The two men yuck it up. Gallows humor. Bear, for the first time in his life, lives in a predominantly black community, albeit an artificial, warped one, for it is bereft of the laughter of women or the bawling of babes. Only men live here, mostly young black men. Welcome to Huntington's death row, one of 3 in Pennsylvania. The denizens of death row are black as molasses and the staff are white bread. Long-termers on the row, those here since 1984, recall a small but seemingly significant event that took place back then. Maintenance and construction staff, forced by a state court order and state statute to provide men with a minimum of 2 hours daily outside exercise rather than the customary 15 minutes every other day, erected a number of steel cyclone-fenced boxes which strikingly resemble dog runs or pet pens. Although staff assured inmates that the pens would be used only for disciplinary cases, the construction ended and the assurances were put to the test. The first day after completion of the cages, death cases, all free of any disciplinary infractions, were marched out to the pens for daily exercise outdoors. Only when the cages were full did full recognition dawn that all the caged men were African. Where were the white cons of death row? A few moments of silent observation proved the obvious. The death row block offered direct access to 2 yards, one composed of cages, the other free space, water fountains, full-court basketball spaces and hoops, and an area for running. The cages were for the blacks on death row. The open yards were for the whites on the row. The blacks, due to racist insensitivity and sheer hatred, were condemned to awaiting death in indignity. The event provided an excellent view, in microcosm, of the mentality of the criminal system of injustice suffused by the toxin of racism. The notes of a youthful law clerk of 1953 are the ruling opinions of America's highest court of today. The clerk of yesteryear is today's chief justice, and the word South can be juxtaposed with North, West, East, or even court, with equal applicability. A people who once looked to the court for enlightened protection now face only hostility. Nowhere is that clearer than in capital cases before the court, for at the heart of this country's death penalty scheme is the crucible of race. Who would dare argue otherwise after examining the pivotal case McCleskey v. Kemp, 1987, where the court took a delicate moonwalk backward away from a mountain of awesome evidence that showed incontrovertibly that, one, defendants charged with killing white victims in Georgia are 4.3 times as likely to be sentenced to death as defendants charged with killing blacks, two, race of the victim determines whether a death penalty is returned, 3. Nearly 6 of every 11 defendants convicted of killing whites would not have gotten the death penalty had their victim been black. 4. 20 of every 34 black defendants would not have received the death penalty had their victims been black. And 5. Cases involving black defendants and white victims are more likely to result in a death sentence than cases featuring any other racial combination of defendant and victim. McCleskey's claims, wrote the court's centrist Justice Powell, cannot prevail because, taken to its logical conclusion, McCleskey throws into serious question the principles that underlie our entire criminal justice system. Put quite another way, the McCleskey court denied relief while accepting as valid his data proving the above five statements, not because his studies or their conclusions were untrue, but because of the impact such findings would have on other cases. Welcome to the Great March Backward. McCleskey, of course, was not alone. At base, McCleskey revealed a system of demonstrable, documented imbalance where race of victim and race of defendant determined whether one would live or die. This, the court said, was perfectly constitutional. Robert A. Burt, a Yale law scholar, has examined the implications of McCleskey in light of the 1986 case Lockhart v. McCree, where the court similarly rejected the argument that a death qualified pro-prosecution, pro-capital punishment jury offends the fundamental constitutional command for a fair, impartial jury. Professor Burt notes, when we add this finding, i.e., that Lockhart juries tend to be white and male because blacks and women are generally anti-death penalty and are thus excluded, to the evidence gathered in McCleskey that capital juries impose the death penalty with disproportionate frequency on blacks who murder whites and infrequently in response to any murders of blacks, a grim portrait of the American criminal justice system emerges. This portrait shows that law enforcement in the most serious and publicly visible cases is entrusted predominantly to groups of white men who value white lives more than blacks, and thus they take special vengeance on blacks who murder whites and are much less concerned about the murder of blacks. Indeed, its low valuation of blacks, coupled with its special arousal when blacks murder whites, suggests a law enforcement regime that acts as if our society were gripped by fears about and prepared to take preemptive strikes against an explosion of race warfare. As of July 25, 1988, the State Court Administrator's Office recorded 107 people on Pennsylvania's death row, and of that total, 50 from Philadelphia alone. Of that 50, 40 were of African blood, with 7 whites and 3 Hispanics. Statewide, blacks, only 9% of the population, emerge as a clear majority on Pennsylvania's death row. Nationally, the picture is equally bleak, as Africans, just over 11% of the nation's total, grow into 40% of America's national death row. More often than not, capital punishment in America carries a black, brown, or red face. From daybreak to dusk, black voices resound in exchanges of daily dramas that mark time in the dead zone. The latest on a lawyer, the latest on a lover, tidbits of thought bouncing off bars of steel and walls of stone, relentlessly in the wait for death. Echoes of Dred Scott ring in today's McCleskey opinion, again noting the paucity of rights held by Africans in the land of the free, who had for more than a century before been regarded as beings of an inferior order and altogether unfit to associate with the white race, either in social or political relations, and so far inferior that they had no rights which the white man was bound to respect. Chief Justice Taney sits again, reincarnate, on the Rehnquist Court of the modern age. Taney's court, in Scott, left intact the power of the slaver by denying constitutional rights to Africans, even those born in the United States. Rehnquist's court in McCleskey leaves intact the power of the state to further cheapen black life. 133 years after Scott, and still unequal in life as in death. April 1990. From an echo in darkness, a step into light. Psst, psst. Yo, Moo, Moo, you up? Asks the Italian Cherokee tear runner, his accent betraying his South Philly roots. Stirring from the mattress, I trudge to the cell door, look down to where Mike stands, and glower at his bright face. What's up, man? I grumble at sleep's interruption. You ready for this? Mike asks rhetorically, his face ablaze with a smile. Man, what's up? I demand, a bit peeved at the wordplay. Jay Smith, he's going home. Mike announces, and a heartfelt sense of happiness at another man's good fortune lifts my mood instantly. No shit, Mike? Swear to God, Moo, he's packing his gear right now. Says he got an order from the Supreme Court throwing out his conviction. Ain't that something? Yeah, Mike, that's something wonderful. Long live John Africa. That's good news, man. Jay Smith, a common Anglo-Saxon, everyday American name, belonged to an old, quiet, gray-haired, professional white dude who, until recently, was among 149 souls on Pennsylvania's death row after his conviction for 3 killings that sparked national attention, several books, and a television movie. Prosecutors, police, and the press painted him as an arch-demon, a twisted sadist, a triple killer, and an all-around not-so-nice guy, light years from the lower Marion school principal and army reservist his neighbors and students knew. Having read a news article depicting him as cold and evil with goat-like gray eyes, I half expected when I met him to see him bounding around on 2 cloven hooves. But on appeal, it appeared as if the real animals, skunks, sent him to death row, for the Supreme Court reversed his conviction, citing prosecutorial misconduct, and his lawyer steadily uncovered lying cops, hidden evidence, and secret deals between investigators and a Hollywood novelist for inside info on the case. His prosecutor, who rose to national office on his case, fell just as swiftly when arrested and convicted on cocaine-related charges. On Friday, September 18, 1992, at midday, the word came to Smith that his case was over, the prosecution discharged, the defendant free to go. encaged in Pennsylvania hellholes, and on death row since 1979, Jay Smith packed his meager possessions, sent a few bye-byes around, shook off the ashes of 12 years, and walked away, stepping back into life. All the books, the multi-million dollar movies of the week, and the damning news articles paled beside the reality of one man walking from the stagnant cesspool of prison into freedom. When one reporter asked him about his plans, he replied, "I don't know. I've been fighting so long for this that I hadn't planned for anything beyond. I'm 64. Maybe in a year I can collect Social Security." But what security exists in a system that plotted, lied, connived, and hid evidence to destroy one man's life that took 12 years from his life, his profession, his family? September 1992.
Text of white supremacy. That will wrap up our second audio segment. We'll pick up next week. Let's see. What is this one? Got thrown off on my page count here. Oh, okay. There we go. So next week we'll pick up we're still pretty early in the book for me. This is Night Raiders. Night Raiders Meet Rage. We're on page 44 in the text. Night Raiders Meet Rage. That's what we'll pick up at for next week. Live from Death Row. If you have questions, comments from the second audio or any portion of what we cover today, the number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. If you didn't get to share at all, make sure you go up. Make sure you go ahead. Speak up now. Don't wait till the last moment if we missed you during the first portion of the audio. I'll just get in. It's striking, that last essay that we heard, where Jay Smith, this white man who I guess got out after had been there unjustly, had a movie done about him and all that. They say, long live John Africa. They give praise to John Africa for this white man, suspected racist, being released. While, yeah, given everything we just heard, I thought that was... That's where we ended at this week. Significant. Folks have comments to share. *61. If you didn't get to share at all, definitely get your hand up. We'll make sure we do not miss you. Let's see. So, retired firefighter Irie Thomas in New York. Let's see. All of y'all are here. I'll nab other Chicago. Henry in Chicago. I'll nab other folks as I see hands.
Copy her.
Thomas in New York, yes, sir.
Yeah, Josh, it always disappoints me when you talk about all the amenities of Seattle and your libraries, because you know, the closest one to me is three blocks away, and it's in Harlem River Projects, and that's a little. It's about the size of a two-bedroom apartment. It's a farm. You would be like, never saw nothing like it in my life. Either way, did you say that he comes on, Mamiya comes on Amy Goodman's show?
I did. I guess it's Democracy Now. I mean, yeah. Anyway, I'll make that one of the audio segments, but they will do phone our reports. I'm trying to think, because they've had him on to talk about a lot of different things. Like, they'll have him on to talk about his case or just other things. That matter of fact, let me pull it up right now, because I'm sure it'll be like, it's not a one-time thing. Like, Democracy Now! Has been on for a long time, right? So, you know, I'd say they probably have him on every, maybe once every other year or so, if I had to take a guess.
Wow, I was just gonna say, man, that's white power there. I mean, white Jewish power on top of that. I mean, she could get pulled strings to get someone on death row. It has to be cavity searched to see someone in a non-physical, but she could get him on the news so everyone in the world could see him. That's amazing. Long live John Africa. I wrote that note down too. After I found out that this was a white guy who seemingly as he said, a demon. I mean, he killed three people. It might have been, supplanted evidence or whatever, but just I thought, man, was he saying that like as a good thing? Or I didn't quite catch it. So I think what you just said put it in context for me, like, oh, okay, so maybe he used this as a victory, for himself, then again, just sitting here talking about it makes me think, man, that probably in his situation is like hope, it's something for him to live for, maybe I can get out of here one day, but other than that, that's all I had to say about the second reading was, the way he described this person and a white person suspected of killing three people. I don't know if they were black or not, probably not, but either way, movies and stuff made out of him, so he's coming out of jail a very wealthy man probably, so just interesting. I wonder if Mamiya, if he's released, if he has any resources and things from all of the stuff he's published and from doing Amy Goodman show and things like that, but I'll leave my line, Justin.
For sure. I did a search on Democracy Now. I just put in Mumia's name and I got over 200 results. Now, sometimes it won't necessarily be him. It'll just be that they talk about him. But I mean, they do talk about Mumia. He is referenced regularly and they do have him on the program. I played a sound clip of him from Democracy Now on the compensatory call in. And one of our investors noted the call was interrupted. If you have had a phone call with someone who's in greater confinement, sometimes they'll interrupt and it'll be like, this call is coming from Rikers Island or such and such correctional facility. It may be, whatever the recording is to let you know you're talking to somebody in greater confinement. That happened while they were talking to him on Democracy Now. And I think it happened several times.
Okay.
It was like it was ticking.
Yeah, so
go ahead.
You just explained it to me, Gus, because I do know that sometimes when you play his clips, it's real crystal clear. And sometimes when you play his clips, it's like he's on a jail phone talking. Mm-hmm. And you can hear the, so that's when he's on Democracy Now, you're saying.
Well, it just depends because he does do interviews. I know he's done interviews on like KPFK in California, which is public radio, and Democracy Now and other outlets. I think J.R. Valray, Minister of Information, he had him on California Public Radio, Black Report Radio several times. So he does, quite a bit of broadcasting from where he does. I think it just varies. Sometimes the recordings might be like an audio recording, like somebody has a recorder or what have you, and they're able to do it that way. And then I think sometimes it's over a phone. So that's why sometimes you hear a lot of yelling in the background and that sort of thing, or the interruptions where they'll come on with the automated message.
Thank you, sir. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, this is one of the interviews that I found, that there are many. This one is from October of 2016, and I'm just reading the transcript. Amy Goodman, she says, "We are joined now by Mumia Abu-Jamal, who just called in from prison in Pennsylvania." Now, he was not on death row at the time, 2016. "Mumia, we did not expect this call. Can you talk about your thoughts right now on the election as you watch behind bars in this very unusual 2016 electoral season?" And he goes on, they talk, you can listen to it, but he talks about the election and they have a number of the, he talks about his health problems, his hepatitis C, and they weren't treating him for that. So they talk about a number of things, but I mean, this wasn't even planned. So you talk about white power. I don't know how many inmates who he would still be a lifer who've been in prison for this long can just, you know, hop on their phone and ring up Amy Goodman and get on a live broadcast where it's not even planned. We didn't even have a scheduled, I mean, if that's to be believed, even if it wasn't, I don't know how many people could do that and to regularly be able to get, you know, at Amy Goodman and all these other outlets. I mean, that is, yeah, that is something to consider. Other folks have commentary that they wanted to share. While folks are getting their thoughts together, I'll go back over my second portion of notes. Just that what I said about that last little portion that we read there at the conclusion, this white guy, Jay Smith, who gets out while all these other black inmates, black males, he said, are stuck there. That to me seems like audience. We talk about editing, like not saying white supremacy and that sort of thing. This anecdote. Now, I'm not saying that it's not true. This totally may have happened. Although, according to his own numbers, you know, that it's so black on death row that, you know, but okay, we let's say that it's true. Let's go with that. This goes to what I said about, hey, audience, let's make sure that we widen the appeal. You're on death row. He was at the time that this was written. Let's get more support. If we get white people are more powerful. You might only have to get 4 or 5 white people, and they might, you know, be enough to get this thing moving in the correct direction. That might have been the type of language, you know, logical. Like, you know, this isn't to compromise your voice. This is to try to help you get out of jail. So let's make sure that we're not writing something where they can say that, oh, you hate white people. And you don't like white people and you hate all white people. Let's make sure that we can write this in a way that, you know, that it shows that you have you're pulling for Jay Smith. You're happy for him. He was locked up for 11 years and you were happy to see that he's getting out of here, even if you weren't. Long live John Africa. I could see. And plus, this is such a short little anecdote. It's not even a whole lot of information here. You know, just the movie and what happened and it was wrong. And then it's over. Like it ends on page 43. It starts on page 40. What is that? You know, that's what I mean. It's not. What purpose does that little nugget there serve other than that? Appeal to a white reader, I think. And that happens in a few ways. I think even the section before that, which goes into more of the McCleskey court case, important information, that would kind of be another one where I'd look at and say, now, who is this written for? Some of these essays, it seems, were published in like legal reviews, law journals. I mean, they're you know, going over court cases and looking at legal reviews, legal precedents. I could see where some of this could be published in a law review. I think one of these was in the Yale Law Review, and he's talking about a law professor. So who's the audience? Who's supposed to be reading this information? Or at minimum, it seems like it's appealing to white people in these positions. And again, if it's Yale Law Review and that sort of thing, we might be appealing to white attorneys who could help get us off a death row, pick up a pro bono case, get you some attention, and, you know, help me figure my way out of this legal quagmire. I get it. That's logical. But the information about in that second to last essay that we read, where they're talking about the, let's put the McCleskey report decision in context, where black males in particular are over 4 times more likely to get the death penalty if the victim is a white person. Putting that in context with the infrequency of a white person being punished for violating a black person, and the language that he said about what does this mean about a society that seems like it is designed in a very punitive way to attack black people, and this sort of fear or thought that, you know, black people might be out to get white people. That is very slave reminiscent. That's how the plantation operated, that there might be more Nat Turners. There might be more Denmark Vesey's. There might be more black people who are attempting to do something about white supremacy racism, We got to send a message. Any of you all try to do something, this is what will happen. We got to strike fear, terrorism. We got to strike fear in them. This is what will happen if you do so. I thought that was really important, even though included, you know, from, I suspect, a white author, super important information. Let's see. I thought the portion where he talked about the visit from his daughter, that was really powerful, really painful. We talked about humiliation, and I think that right there, totally stripping family ties, human connections to even be able to touch another human being. Like, the only touching that's going to be allowed is me coming to grope and violate you with our cavity search and all the rest to see that you aren't smuggling crack cocaine and the rest of your contraband that we don't give you, by the way. Only contraband you're going to have is what we give, what we provide. But no touching, no hugs, no none of that. You're an animal. You're a convict. We want to remind you of that at all times. But I can grasp, I think, some the effect of this is supposed to be that the family does not want to endure this, the humiliations, because that the searches and all that, they do that to them as well sometimes. Frequently, we've had reports on that. They don't want to endure this. They don't want to see you enduring this, vice versa. So the designed impact, exactly what he said, erode those family connections. So you're just further isolated. Can just do more and more and more harm to you and further erode your humanity away in greater confinement, all by design. But that was really painful. In 40 years, imagine that, having to be a father. We can kind of lose sight of that and just think of the individual and not think, oh, he's a father and a husband. And, you know, there's a child who has been missing for the last 40 years, her parent, you know, and had to go through all this. Let's see. The mental health, really talk. We spent so much time talking about mental health on the program. Him talking about, hey, now contrast Jay Smith, this white guy, he gets released. Now they've done a movie on him and all the rest. Harry Washington, he doesn't get a movie. Black guy going crazy. And a part of his going crazy, him yelling niggers. Keep your racist garbage. Stop talking about my family. That's his going crazy, where he's classified as a nut. That even reminded me the Khalif Browder documentary that Jay-Z did. They spent a lot of time talking about that, mental health, doing the same things, having black people isolated, having them in solitary confinement, knowing that this is going to take a toll on their mental health. They already know this. We're going to use language because we know that this is going to drive, it's designed to drive you insane, where you might not recuperate. We already know this. We study this. We study the Negro. We study how to break the Negro. Doing the same thing, just more refined techniques. But I thought that was extremely important. And again, Mumia is a human being as well. He's not talking as though he's immune. The health deterioration and everything that he's gone through to be there for this period and to for he himself to endure all of this and to still be cranking out and reporting and writing, it's astonishing. Let's see. The drugging, I thought, was important. He talked about the Supreme Court ruling where correctional facilities, they're allowed to drug inmates. Wow. I'm sure some of these people, that's how they got here. War on drugs, especially this time period. That's how they got here. Now we're going to get here and it's, oh, we got to give you some drugs so you'll settle down a bit. Give you some drugs and put you in front of the television. Like, wow. And then complain that we got a recidivism problem. You get all the, what happens if you get addicted to whatever drugs they have you on while you're in prison and then you get out and you don't have access to those drugs anymore? What happens then? Let's see. The same thing I said before in the languaging, in the way that we talk about racism, white supremacy, it seemed like a lot of languaging around conservatives. You hear a lot of that today, conservative, right wing, as though it's Donald Trump's fault. I guess at this time period, it would have been, would that have been George Bush, I think. George H.W. Herbert Walker, I think, for this period. We'll blame it on him or blame it on Reagan. That's just not understanding accurately white supremacy racism when he says the notes of a youthful law clerk of 1953. That's what I mean about name dropping. All of this name dropping of white law clerks. I could see where this could be a means of appealing to white law students. Maybe they might be interested. White activists. The notes of a youthful law clerk of 1953 are the ruling opinions of America's highest court of today. The clerk of yesteryear is today's chief justice, and the word South can be juxtaposed with North, West, East, or even court. And this is him echoing when he started the chapter saying that the South doesn't like black people. And that's not accurate at all. It's individuals classified as white. It's not even South, West, East, North. It is the global system known universe. We talk about that on such a regular basis. How are you going to mention Nelson Mandela in this text, which he already did, system of white supremacy, and then come back and say that in some manifestation, this problem is about white people in the South? Got to be. That's why I said, Dr. Welsing, I started to have a much greater appreciation for people that if you're going to talk about racism, doing so in an accurate manner. It is very difficult to find people who are willing and able to do that. Willing and able. Mumia Abu-Jamal might not be able. Not that he's not informed, but Noelle Hanrahan might not allow him. She might not be willing to do those recordings, you know, if he talked about racism, white supremacy in a more blunt manner. I'll stop there. Any other folks, sections, anything of significance stood out from the first or the second audio, either portion that we've read so far?
No.
Yes, Ira, you're a little, your volume is a little low, if you could speak up.
Okay, is this better?
Yes, ma'am.
All right. You were talking about that invented fear of black people in order to, you know, put them in greater confinement. It's like what I thought about while I was waiting is there's fear, right? And there's an acronym for it, false evidence appearing real. So for them, they create this false evidence of us and what we'll do to them and what we're capable of. And then, you know, of course, to maintain order their way, you know, they punish black people, black men, you know, more harshly for this false evidence that they've imposed on themselves. But then we develop a fear, and that's factual evidence appearing real, because it is real, you know, that there are people that, you know, if they want you in jail, like with Momia, they will invent something and then put you in there. And then because people see a person's, you know, prosecution and therefore or hence their, you know, conviction, then everybody else has stress and anxiety and fear, you know, just going about their daily lives. And then, like you said, just further putting more value on white lives. And letting us know your life is not valuable, because if you are murdered by someone non-white, black, or whatever, they'll probably get, you know, be able to get paroled out eventually, maybe, you know. As far as the mental health thing, there's an interesting poem I heard on Michelle Indigail Cello's album. Geez, I can't think of it now. I think it's Cookie, the anthology. But she has in one of the songs, "Hard Rock returns to prison from the hospital for the criminally insane." And this poem is by Etheridge Knight. And in the poem, he talks about how this prisoner, dubbed Hard Rock in the poem, is made a, you know, like in a, he's a shell of himself because he's been lobotomized. And everybody, you know, basically is commenting like, wow, this man really was, you know, a stone cold killer. And now they've made him into, you know, as gentle as a caterpillar, basically, because of the dismembering of his brain. When I was in college for graphic design, my instructor at the time, white woman from Poland, she mentioned to us that there's a certain pink that will drive you insane, or any person insane, I should say, and that that was basically played around with in prisons, and they had to, I guess eventually they decided that was not a good thing to do. I'm not sure what the manifestations was, but they're constantly playing with the brains of the imprisoned, death row or not. And then I wanted to say, I hope I'm not taking too long. White people, Amy Goodman, I do watch Democracy Now! Every now and then to get like general headlines, but I know she and many others probably adhere to, Mr., you know, Abu Jamal's case, because it's their way to say, hey, look, I'm not racist. I'm helping this guy on death row. You know, he's black. Look at me. And then the last thing I also want to say is, when white people want you out of prison, you get out. What's her name? Centoria Brown. And I'm not saying she didn't deserve it. I did feel for her. But her, and I mean, she came to my mind first. I know there's others. And the guy in the book, they went through the extent of making a movie in order to create propaganda to aid this man becoming free. So when white people want you out of prison, they'll get you out. And if they want you there, you'll stay there. And I will end my term for now. I'll wait for the end of the show for the books.
Much obliged, Irie. Let's see if any other folks have suggestions, comments on Live from Death Row, Mumia Abu-Jamal, our debut session. Any other comments, suggestions, questions folks want to share? Assuming folks are satisfied this time around. I'm checking back myself, make sure I didn't.
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Retired firefighter.
Yes, I'm looking forward to studying his works because he has been on your program for a long period of time. And I know about the case of the enforcement official that was killed, but I don't have enough. I'm not satisfied with the amount of details that I have, and maybe also his understandings of racism, white supremacy. Maybe that will be revealed through this text a little bit better about where his thoughts are on the subject. And because otherwise I hadn't really studied him directly. So, yeah, looking forward to it.
Much obliged, retired firefighter. I think that is the case with a number of folks where they had maybe heard his name from time to time, but don't have like a lot of intimate details about either his case or his life and times, what he was doing before he was in prison, all of that. So, yeah, hopefully this will be a good chance for all of us to get a little bit more info on who this fella is and why he's been mentioned. Might be mentioned, but like I said, if they have that trial, oh, man, he'll be talked about a whole lot more. Any other folks, questions, suggestions, comments they want to share? we'll assume folks are good for now. We will be back next week. This book isn't really super long, so we shouldn't be on it too long. Definitely should take us into the new year, but I mean, before we get to Valentine's Day, we should be off onto something else. So hopefully we'll have fun, learn a lot, and be ready to roll 2020 with a new book once we're all done with this one. We had suggestions for young adult literature. We just talked about this on the compensatory call-in. So glad to have Ari with suggestions. Young, eager reader, think sixth grade if memory serves, where she loves to read. She's reading The Abomination, The Hate U Give, which we already read on the cows. We want to give her something quality to cleanse her palate. Take it away, Ari.
All right. I think these will work. The first one, I don't have the author, but it is Rabbit Proof Fence, about two young girls kidnapped from their home in Australia. Gives a perspective of racism, you know, in another continent, and their adamant attempt to get back to their family, despite being thousands of miles away. The next book, and I'm suggesting this because I thought I heard you say she's 16, so I think she'll be able to read this. It is Random Family. If she's younger than 16, then I wouldn't recommend it. But if she's 16 or older, Random Family by Adrienne Nicole LeBlanc, and this is basically about a white, this is a white woman reporter that follows a family in the Bronx. This is a true accounting of this family in the Bronx who live below the poverty line. They're subjected to violence, drugs, police activity. She follows them for 10 years and basically compiles their stories in this book. And one of the people that she wrote about is pictured on the cover. And then the last book, The Best of Simple by Langston Hughes. And I really love this book in middle school because it gave me reflections or an insight on some of the things my grandmother would tell me about, you know, the world growing up post the, you know, World War II and the Great Depression. So there's going to be mentions of that. It also has talks about racism. And it was really, really funny. And, of course, it's Langston Hughes, and I think she might like that if she wants to read something that's lighthearted, give her a little bit of laugh, and, you know, just expand her palate. Now, in my turn, good night, everybody. Thank you.
Love it, love it, love it. I hope I said sixth grade, not 16. She's, I think, memory is accurate, sixth grade, so not quite 16. I think sixth grade, that would be like 11, maybe.
Okay,
Brack
Random Family, please.
Oh, okay. We'll put that in the reserve. Put that one in the hopper, so a few years down the road, we'll be ready to roll on that one as well. But at least for right now, sixth grade. Is memory accurate, Henry in Chicago, if he's still with us? Sixth grade, that's our young scholar's reading age. Might not be with us. It's in the archives, though. We went over it. And I think it's sixth grade. But if any other folks have literature books that are constructive, hopefully they can be written by a black author, too. That would be great. But featuring some black people, constructive presentation of black people, and something that would help motivate, encourage a young black scholar, young black boy, young black girl to keep up reading, let us know. You can share on the compensatory call in or what have you. Anyway, we'll be here tomorrow. Workplace racism, same time, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. And then on Saturday, compensatory call in, 9 p.m. Eastern, 6 p.m. Pacific. And we'll also be here Monday. Clifford Thompson, he's a black male. He wrote the book What It Is, which is about Trump winning the 2016 election, he went out to interview white men exclusively to figure out why they were supporting Trump so he could better understand racism and the so-called country. But he should be here on Monday. His book is an interesting read. Me, I'm such a dunce. He was just here in Seattle. He was at the exact same bookstore that Azur Savage was at. And I think within a matter of days, like if I had just I did look at the calendar. I thought if I had maybe spent an extra minute or two looking at the calendar, I would have saw his name and I could have went right back and saw Clifford Thompson. But no matter. He'll be here on Monday, 8 p.m. Eastern, 5 p.m. Pacific. Black Male. You can check out. I think we did play an audio segment about his book not too long ago. What it is the title of it. It is. I forgot the cowbell, but that'll be for Monday. Yeah. Clifford Thompson. Cowbell. Woo. Anywho. That'll do it for today. Live from Death Row, we'll be back next Thursday. Much obliged for everyone's participation. I hope it was worthy of your time and energy. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. You hear what they're doing to the prisoners. Drug them with the TV, and then we drug them with actual narcotics, and then do all that cavity searching and such in the name of, oh, we want to promote sobriety. We don't want you sneaking in any crack cocaine. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger, or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. In addition to being sober and buckled in, if you are driving, you are not on the cell phone. Just doing everything we can to try to be as safe as we can under extraordinarily dangerous conditions. That said, Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cal signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim,
your
brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.